Everybody ready for a little story, a little joke?
Yeah.
Something we can laugh at for a change? I love the story about the young Catholic boy. Time for his birthday, and he asked his dad about the possibility of getting a bicycle for his birthday. His dad said, "Well, son, there's nothing I can do to help you." He said, "You got 4, 5, 6 brothers and sisters. I can just barely feed them, much less buy bicycles." The little boy said, "Well, what could I do about it?" And the dad said, "Well, won't you write a letter to God and see what happens? You never know." So the little boy goes to his bedroom and sits down at his desk and gets a pencil and a piece of paper, and he begins to write. And he said, "Dear Jesus," he said, "I'm a little Catholic boy, and I'm 14 years old, and I've never had a bike." He said, "Ah, shit, that wouldn't work." And he tore it up, and he threw it away. And he sat there and thought a little more and got a piece of paper again. And he said, "Dear God, I'm a little Catholic boy, and I'm 14 years old, and I'm a good member of the church, and I do it." He said, "Nah, hell, that won't work." Tore it up and threw it away. And he's sitting there looking around, and he happened to look up on his dresser, and there was a statuette of the Virgin up there. And his eyes lit up, and he grabbed that statuette, opened up his underwear drawer, reached in there and got a roll of socks, unrolled them, put the statuette inside the socks, rolled them back up, put them way back in the back of the underwear drawer, very carefully covered them up, closed the drawer, sat down at his desk and got a pencil and piece of paper, and he said, "Dear Jesus, if you ever want to see your mama again..." I bet he was one of us. What do you bet, huh? Okay, we're going to look now for a little bit here at Bill's story. And I think to really see where Bill's story fits in the big book, in the proper location, and the way it does, you have to go back and put our minds back in the thinking of 1937, 38, and 39. Remember, Bill learned the value of one alcoholic sharing his story with another alcoholic when he went to see Dr. Bob. Prior to that, Bill always started talking to them about spirituality. Silkworth said, "Don't do that. Explain to them the exact nature of their illness. Then you could get their attention, and then you talk about spirituality." So Bill learned the value of through the sharing of his story with Dr. Bob, then Dr. Bob was able to see his problem too, the physical allergy, the obsession of the mind, just as we've been able to see it here in the doctor's opinion. Then they went to see Bill Dodson, and through the sharing of their stories with Bill Dodson could see his problem, he could see the solution, and he could see the program of action. So in the very beginning, they learned this value of one drunk sharing with another. And from that day on, when they went out to talk to a new person wherever they found them, they sat down and shared their stories with them. When the big book was printed, though, they knew that the first person up here in Vermont, the first person in the state of Kansas, the first person down in Texas, that they wouldn't be able to go visit with them and share their story on a one-on-one basis. So the big book had to be complete enough to do the whole job. And they said, "Well, what we need to do is put somebody's story here right in the beginning of the book so that the newcomer will be able to read that story and identify with another alcoholic." And of course, they made the decision to put Bill's story in here. And it really serves two or three purposes. Number one, it's identification, one alcoholic sharing with another. A lot of people say, "Well, we can't identify with Bill, because after all, he was a New York City stock speculator, and we were not. Or he was a New York City lawyer, and we were not." A lot of the women say, "We can't identify with him because he's a man rather than the female." But I think if we all read Bill's story looking for identification, we're going to be able to see the way he thought, the way he felt, his actions and reactions to life, people, places, and things in general. I think we're all going to be able to identify with Bill when we look at those particular things, rather than the fact that he was a New York City stock speculator or that he was a man instead of a woman. Another purpose in Bill's story, it is a classic example of what the doctor talked about in the doctor's opinion. We're going to be able to see Bill start his drinking, and it was a lot of fun and very exciting for him. But we're going to see the progression of his alcoholism. We're going to see him go from fun drinking to drinking all day and almost every night. We're going to be able to see him going to drinking out of absolute necessity in order to live. And then finally, we're going to see Bill drinking for the sickest reason of all, absolute, complete oblivion, just to get out of the picture entirely. And we'll be able to see the progression of his alcoholism. And then the greatest thing we're going to be able to see in Bill's story is recovery from alcoholism. And if we're a new person, we've never had any contact with the fellowship, the first real contact is Bill's story. And we read it and we identify with another alcoholic, and we see him recover from alcoholism, then we can begin to believe too. The beginning of hope, the beginning of belief that if this guy could recover, just maybe we could too. Two or three different things we see out of Bill's story. It fits in here just exactly where it should be. Keeping in mind that the reader of the book had never had any contact with the fellowship, Bill was their first real contact. Joe?
When I first read his book, I didn't think about Bill, as identify with Bill in any manner. But after all, I'd seen pictures of him, and he was an old man, I thought, so what would he have to tell me? Come to find out, Bill was relatively a young man at 43 years old when he wrote this book. As I began to study Bill's writings and study Bill, I realized that Bill was a very optimistic individual, extremely hardworking, had lots and lots of willpower, and with those ordinary attributes, he was a self-made man. He did real well that way. But Bill's story tells the whole story of Alcoholics Anonymous. In Bill's story, we're going to learn what he was like, how he learned he was sick, and most importantly, we're going to see how he affected the recovery. So let's go back to page one, Bill's story, and let's start looking for identification. He said, war fever ran high in that New England town to which we knew young officers from Plattsburgh were assigned. We were flattered when the first citizens took us to their homes, making us feel heroic. Here was love, applause, war, moments sublime with intervals hilarious. I love the way Bill writes. Has anybody ever had any moments sublime with intervals hilarious? Boy, I have. He said, I was part of life at last, and in the midst of the excitement, I discovered liquor. I forgot the strong warnings and the prejudices of my people concerning drink. In time, we sailed for over there. I was very lonely and again turned to alcohol. We landed in England. I visited Winchester Cathedral. Much moved, I wandered outside. My attention was caught by a goggle on an old tombstone. Here lies a Hampshire grenadier who caught his death drinking cold, small beer. A good soldier never forgot whether he died by musket or by pot.
Now, for you younger people, the pot we're referring here to is not that wacky weed you've been using. It's a pot of beer, which is the way it used to be sold in England. When you went in a place to buy it, you bought a pot of beer.
I have a picture of this doggerel here, the tombstone, and the name on it was Thatcher. This guy's name was Thatcher. Kind of strange, isn't it? Abby Thatcher and the Thatcher. If anybody wants to look at it, I'll show it to him later. So the ominous warning, which I failed to heed. 22 and a veteran of foreign wars, I went home at last. I fancied myself a leader, for had not the men of my battery given me special token of appreciation? My talent for leadership, I imagined, would place me at the head of vast enterprises, which I would manage with the utmost assurance. He said, I took a night law course and obtained employment as an investigator for a surety company. The drive for success was on. I proved to the world that I was important.
I already identified with Bill Wilson. It's all I ever wanted to do, succeed at something, prove to the world that I'm important also. One of the great driving characteristics behind every alcoholic I've ever met is to show them and prove to them that we're just as good as they are. Certainly identify with Bill Wilson.
Can you imagine Bill Wilson leaving a place like this and going to New York City? It's quite a change for a guy like him. He said, my work took me about Wall Street. Little by little, I became interested in the market. Many people lost money, but some became very rich. Well, why not I? I studied economics and business as well as law. potential alcoholic that I was, I nearly failed my law course. At one of the finals, I was too drunk to think or to write. Though my drinking was not yet continuous, it disturbed my wives. I can identify with Bill. Yeah. My wives were very disturbed. We had long talks when I was still her forebodings by telling her that men of genius conceive their best projects when drunk.
I have no problem identifying with Bill Wilson.
Charlie said last night we make our living selling fast talk to slow thinking people. Well, Bill's trying to do some of that right here. So by the time I completed the course, I knew the law was not for me. The inviting maelstrom of Wall Street had me in its grip. Business and financial leaders were my heroes. Out of this alloy of drink and speculation, I commenced to forge the weapon that one day would turn its flight like a boomerang and all but cut me to ribbons. Now, living modestly, my wife and I saved $1,000. It went into certain securities, then cheap and rather unpopular. I rightly imagined that they would someday have a great rise. I failed to persuade my broker friends to send me out looking over factories and management, but my wife and I decided to go anyway. I had developed a theory that most people lost money in stocks through ignorance of markets. I discovered many more reasons later on.
Now, Bill is referring to a time back in the 1920s. Stock market was on a roll. Just about everybody that dealt with stocks made money. That all you had to do was buy them, hold them a while, let them go up in price, sell them, take your profits, buy some more. Everything was done on about a 10% margin. You didn't have to have very much money to get into the business. Everything was really going great. Bill really became one of the first investment counselors on Wall Street. He began to say to those people that had the money, he began to say, look, you know, sooner or later this bubble's going to burst. Sooner or later we're going to have to start making our decisions based on fact rather than speculation. And he said, now I don't have the money to do this, but if you guys would back me financially, I'll go out and I'll examine these companies. I'll look at the physical plan. I'll talk to the employees. I'll look at the books wherever I can. I'll write up reports on them, send them back here to Wall Street, and we'll start making our decisions based on fact rather than speculation. They said, no, Bill, we don't need that kind of information. They said, we're making about all the money we need to make anyhow. And you know how we alcoholics are. If we get a good idea, we're going to carry it out come hell or high water, one way or the other. And he said, to hell with them. We'll just go do this on our own. And the book says we gave up our positions and off we roared on a motorcycle. The sidecar stuffed with tent, blankets, a change of clothes, and three huge volumes of a financial reference service. Our friends thought a lunacy commission should be appointed. Perhaps they were right. I had had some success in speculation, so we had a little money. But we once worked on a farm for a month to avoid drawing on our small capital. That was the last honest manual labor on my part for many a day. We covered the whole eastern United States in a year. For a full year, Bill and Lois, riding on his motorcycle, living in a tent, and etc., traveled the eastern seaboard of the United States, and he wrote up reports on approximately 100 of the largest companies, sent them back into Wall Street. He said, at the end of it, my reports to Wall Street procured me a position there and the use of a large expense account. These guys saw these reports and they said, oh yeah, man, this is great information. Almost immediately, they put Bill on the payroll, gave him a good expense account, and he said the exercise of an option brought in more money, leaving us with a profit of several thousand dollars for that year. For the next few years, fortune threw money and applause my way. I had arrived. How many of us have done the same kind of thing? Just literally worked our tails off for years. And finally we get there and we're on top of the heap and life is great. I'm just like old Bill. I had arrived. He came from up here in Vermont. And he was pretty poor people up there. Never really had anything before in his lifetime. But all of a sudden now, here he is on Wall Street, got this great job, got a good expense account. He's made a profit of several thousand dollars in the market. He's really feeling great. My judgment and ideas were followed by many to the tune of paper millions. The great boom of the late 20s was seething and swelling. Drink was taking an important, exhilarating part in my life. Now, Bill doesn't know he's alcoholic. He just knows that drinking is a fun thing and it's a very exciting thing. There was loud talk in the jazz places uptown. Everyone spinning thousands and chattered in millions. Scoffers could scoff and be damned. I made a host of fair weather friends. Now we know as an alcoholic, his alcoholism is going to be progressive. The drinking is going to continually get worse and worse and worse. Let's see where he goes from here.
Well, Bill was talking up in those jazz places up front town. He was drinking real good whiskey now. Talking in thousands and spending millions. They talk about it and chattering in millions. Boy, they were doing great, weren't they? He said, my drinking assumed a more serious proportions, continuing all day and almost every night. The remorses of my friends terminated around. I became a lone wolf.
People began to say to Bill, you're drinking too much. Bill, you're costing us money. Bill, why don't you cut back? Bill, why don't you quit drinking? And Bill did the same thing you and I did. He said, to hell with them. I don't need them anyhow. Now he becomes a lone wolf. Rather than considering doing something about his drinking, he now begins to operate on his own.
He said there were many unhappy scenes in our Sumter's apartment. There had been no real infidelity, for my loyalty to my wife helped at times by extreme drunkenness kept me out of those scrapes. I've always believed just about everything Bill said. I'm not sure about that statement. You know, Bill wrote a little book up here, said, as Bill sees it. Later on, Lois wrote a little book because Lois remembers. And there's a little bit of difference in that, you know.
Let's go over to page 4, first paragraph.
Now here's old Bill. He's doing good, drinking good whiskey, living in the jazz places uptown, playing golf, feeling good, on top of the world. He had lots of willpower, had lots of hope for the future. Hardworking, optimistic, self-made man. But abruptly, in October 1929, hell broke loose on the New York Stock Exchange. After one of those days of inferno, I wobbled from a hotel bar to a brokerage office. It was 8 o'clock. 5 hours after the market had closed, the ticker still clattered. I was staring at an inch of tape which bore the inscription XYZ32. It had been 52 that morning. He said, well, I was finished, so were many friends. The papers reported men jumping to death in towers of high finance. He said, that disgusted me. I would not jump. I went back to the bar. Bill had a solution, didn't he? Yeah. He said, my friends had dropped several million since 10 o'clock or so what? Tomorrow was another day, and as I drank, that old fierce determination to win came back.
How many of us have done the same thing? We come out of the jailhouse, the divorce court, the hospital, stop off in the bar and have a few drinks, and as the whiskey courses through our veins, we say, we'll show them. They're not going to treat us that way, and we're off and we're running again. That old fierce determination to win, to be somebody, to prove to them, now we're just as good as they are. One of the great driving characteristics behind every alcoholic I've ever known.
He said, next morning I telephoned a friend in Montreal. He had plenty of money left, and I thought I'd better go to Canada. You know, Bill wasn't stupid. He was a drunk. He went where the money was. We all know the money's up in Canada anyhow, don't we? By the following spring, we were living in our accustomed style. I felt like Napoleon returning from Elba. No St. Helena for me. But drinking caught up with me again, and my generous friend had to let me go. This time, we stayed broke. Now, here's old Bill. He's making lots of money, doing real good. Now, look, let's see what happens to him. He said, we went to live with my wife's parents. Boy, that's got to be a come down for a guy like Bill. I found a job and lost as a result of a brawl with a taxi driver. Mercifully, no one could guess that I was to have no real employment for 5 years or hardly draw a sober breath. My wife began to work in the department store, coming home exhausted to find me drunk. I became an unwelcome hanger-on to brokerage places. These brokerage places where Bill used to be welcomed, where his ideas were followed by the tune of Paper Million, where he was a fair-haired boy. Now he's going to these same places and they say to him, Bill, you're just not doing us any good around here. Why don't you just go on down the street and try to peddle your paper someplace else? Just move, get on out of here. So that's got to be a real come down for a guy like Bill.
Now then we begin to drink for an entirely different reason. Liquor ceased to be a luxury, it became a necessity. Bathtub gin, 2 bottles a day, and often 3 got to be routine. We're now drinking because we absolutely have to drink in order to live. The fun's gone, the excitement's gone. Sometimes a small deal would net a few $100s, and I would pay my bills at the bars and delicatessens. This went on endlessly, and I began to waken very early in the morning, shaking violently. A tumbler full of gin, followed by 6 bottles of beer, would be required if I were to eat any breakfast. Nevertheless, I still thought I could control the situation, and there were periods of sobriety which renewed my wife's hope. Remember, Dr. Silkworth said we really cannot differentiate the truth from the false. We see Bill's life going to hell in a handbasket already. Bill can't see that. He thinks he can still control the situation.
Things are real bad for Bill, but it's going to get worse.
Gradually, things got worse. Progression of alcoholism. The house was taken over by the mortgage holder. My mother-in-law died. My wife and father-in-law became ill. Then I got a promising business opportunity. Stocks were at the low point of 1932, and I had somehow formed a group to buy. I was to share generously in the profits. Then I went on a prodigious bender, and that chance vanished. This is a story within itself. The people who had the money, they knew how good Bill was at putting these things together. They went to Bill and they said, Bill, we've got a deal for you. An opportunity for you not only to make us some money, but some money for yourself too. And we'd like for you to handle this thing, but the only thing is, you've got to stay sober. You can't drink. And Bill said, oh, don't worry about that drinking. I'm through with it anyhow. She said, I'll stay sober. No problem at all. And he began to work on this deal, and he worked on it for a matter of a couple of months. And a night or two before it was to all be finished, they were sitting around in a hotel room. Somebody passed around a bottle of Applejack. It came to Bill, and Bill said, no, thank you, I'm not drinking anymore. And they went right on by him. Came back around after a while, and a guy sitting next to him said, Bill, don't you understand that this Applejack is the best Applejack in the world. It's called Jersey Lightning. You've never had anything like this before. And Bill's mind said, I've never tasted any Jersey Lightning. And with no more thought than that, he reached out, grabbed a bottle, took a drink, triggered the allergy, and blew the whole deal. Now, the importance of it lies within the next statement. He said, I woke up. This had to be stopped. I saw I could not take so much as one drink. I was through forever. Before then, I'd written lots of sweet promises, but my wife happily observed that this time I meant business, and so I did. For the first time, Bill could really differentiate the true from the false. For the first time, he could really see what alcohol's doing to him. He did the same thing that all the rest of us did. He trotted out his willpower, and he said, sick 'em, Will. We're through with that drinking. We'll never take another drink as long as we live. You know, people try to tell us we are weak-willed people. Don't you believe that? We are strong-willed people. Weak-willed people do not become alcoholic. Third time they vomit, they quit drinking. Alcoholic knows there's got to be some way to drink without puking. We damn near kill ourselves. You know, we are strong-willed people. And Bill had a tremendous amount of willpower. And he assumed that willpower would do the job. Let's see where he goes on willpower.
Bill pulled out his willpower and said, second, Will. But you see, Bill doesn't know yet what we learned earlier today, that any time there's a battle going on between the willpower and the obsession of the mind, the obsession of the mind will win out over willpower every time. Shortly after, I came home drunk. There had been no fight. Where had been my high resolve? I simply didn't know. It hadn't even come to mind. Someone had pushed a drink my way, and I'd taken it. Was I crazy? So if your willpower doesn't work, then he begins to question his sanity.
Anybody in here identify with Bill Wilson?
Yeah.
I certainly do.
He said, I began to wonder if such an appalling lack of perspective seemed near being just that. Renewing my resolve, I cried again. Some time passed, and confidence began to be replaced by cocksureness. I could laugh at the gin mills. Now I had what it takes. One day I walked into a cafe to telephone. In no time I was beating on the bar, asking myself how it happened. As the whiskey rose to my head, I told myself I would manage better next time, and I might as well get good and drunk then, and I did.
Anybody identify with Bill Wilson?
Mm-hmm. He said the remorse, horror, and hopelessness of the next morning are unforgettable. The courage to do battle was not there. My brain raced uncontrollably, and there was a terrible sense of impending calamity. I hardly dared cross the street lest I collapse and be run down by an early morning truck, for it was scarcely daylight. An all-night place supplied me with a dozen glasses of ale. My writhing nerves were stilled at last. A morning paper told me the market had gone to hell again, but so would I. The market would recover, but I wouldn't. That was a hard thought. Should I kill myself? No, not now. Did the mental fog settle down? Gin would fix that. Two bottles and a breather. See, if your willpower doesn't work, you begin to question your sanity, and it doesn't work. Then you begin to think about the ultimate sacrifice. Should I kill myself? No, not now. Then he starts drinking for the sickest effect of all, total oblivion. As we said earlier, we know about total oblivion. Only one thing wrong with it is you wake up and you got to start all over again. And that's where we find Bill at this time.
Mind and body are marvelous mechanisms. For mine endured this agony 2 more years. Sometimes I stole from my wife's slender purse when the morning terror and madness were on me. Again, I swayed dizzily before an open window of the medicine cabinet where there was poison, cursing myself for a weakling. There were flights from city to country and back as my wife and I sought escape. Then came the night when the physical and mental torture was so hellish, I feared I would burst through my window sash and all. Somehow I managed to drag my mattress to a lower floor, lest I suddenly leap. A doctor came with a heavy sedative. Next day found me drinking both gin and sedative, and this combination soon landed me on the rocks. People feared for my sanity, so did I. I could eat little or nothing when drinking, and I was 40 pounds underweight. We see a guy now who's dying from malnutrition. You know, we're getting that sugar. We're getting those calories out of that alcohol. But those are empty calories. Fools the body into thinking we're getting enough, but we're getting none of the amino acids, none of the vitamins, none of the proteins, none of the things necessary for life. Practicing alcoholic is dying from malnutrition. If Bill didn't get some help, probably he wouldn't have been around much longer. He said, my brother-in-law is a physician. And this is Dr. Leonard Strong. And by the way, Dr. Strong is buried out here too, where Bill and Lois are buried. And through his kindness and that of my mother, I was placed in a nationally known hospital for the mental and physical rehabilitation of alcoholics, Towns Hospital, New York City, summer of 1933. Under the so-called belladonna treatment, my brain cleared. Belladonna was a drug that they use for withdrawal purposes. Today they use Valium. Hydrotherapy and mild exercise helped much. Hydrotherapy is water treatment. And we got into a couple of old treatment centers over in Australia, and they were still using hydrotherapy. They would strap the alcoholic on a gurney, move them into a shower room, and they had shower heads all the way around the room alternating hot and cold water. And they would move the alcoholic in there, and he'd be in there for about 30 minutes. And it doesn't cure alcoholism, but he sure as hell makes a clean drunk out of you. I know that. They come out of there and their skin all wrinkled up. He said, best of all, I met a kind doctor. And of course, this is Dr. Silkworth, who explained that though certainly selfish and foolish, I'd been seriously ill bodily and mentally. Dr. Silkworth sat down to him and explained to him the ideas of the physical allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind. And Bill said it relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, but often remains strong in other respects. My incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained. For the first time, Bill understood that it's not willpower, it's not moral character, it's not sin, it's an actual illness. Understanding myself now, I fared forth in high hope. For 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high. I went to town regular and even made a little money. Surely, this was the answer, self-knowledge. Now, we know that Bill, in understanding the problem, assumed that from now on, I'll not have to drink anymore. Let's see what happens to it.
Just like the information we got in the doctor's opinion this morning, it said my incredible behavior in the face of the desperate desire to stop was explained. That's what that doctor's opinion did for me. Understanding myself now, I fared forth in a high hope. For 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high. I went to town regularly and even made a little money. Surely this was the answer, self-knowledge. That information in the doctor's opinion, extremely important information. But he said it, but it was not. Just knowing that's not enough. For the frightful day came when I drank once more. The curve of my declining moral and bodily health fell off like a ski jump. After a time, I returned to the hospital.
Now, this is in the summer of 1934. We've been drunk now again for almost a year. We're back in the towns now, the summer of 1934.
He said, this was the finish, the curtain, it seemed to me. My weary and despairing wife was informed that all ended with heart failure during delirium tremens, or I would develop a wet brain perhaps within a year. She would soon have to give me over to the undertaker of the asylum. Bill was laying in that hospital room. He was very, very sick, and Lois and Dr. Silkworth were talking outside his room. And she said, Dr. Silkworth, is there any hope for him? And he said, no, Lois, I don't believe so. We're going to have to give him over to the undertaker of the asylum, but I don't believe he's ever going to stop drinking. That's why you can't scare an alcoholic into quitting drinking. Bill said they did not need to tell me. I knew and almost welcomed the idea. So you can't scare him. He was welcoming the idea. It was a devastating blow to my pride. I, who thought so well of myself, my abilities, and my capacity to surmount obstacles, was cornered at last. Now I was plunged into the dark during that endless possession of solitude gone on before. I thought of my poor wife. There had been much happiness after all. What would I not give to make amends? But that was over now. See, Bill was now without hope. Totally exhausted all hope. They're going to have to give him over to the undertaker or the asylum. And he is hopeless, powerless over this condition.
Now let's look at this next statement very carefully. He said, no words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. I've never seen a better description of step one. No step one written in those days. But here's where Bill took it. He admitted absolute, complete defeat. Alcohol was his master. Now, if that should happen to you and I today, well, chances are we'd say, well, that being the case, I guess I better go to AA. Bill didn't have any AA to go to. He's in the best treatment facility he knows of. And even though he's admitted defeat, taken what we know today as step one, the only thing he can do is leave that hospital, try to stay sober. Trembling, I stepped from the hospital a broken man. Fear sobered me for a bit. Then came the insidious insanity of that first drink. And on Armistice Day 1934, I was off again. Everyone became resigned to the certainty that I would have to be shut up somewhere or would stumble along to a miserable end. How dark it is before the dawn. In reality, that was the beginning of my last debauch. I was soon to be catapulted in what I like to call the fourth dimension of existence. I was to know happiness, peace, and usefulness in a way of life that is incredibly more wonderful as time passes. Near the end of that bleak November, and it must have been pretty bleak. He started drinking on November the 12th, Armistice Day, or 14th, I can't remember. 11th, isn't it? Yeah, left my mind. He started drinking on November the 11th. He'd been drunk now for about 3 weeks. With a certain satisfaction, I reflected there was enough gin concealed about the house to carry me through that night and the next day. My wife was at work. I wondered whether I dared hide a full bottle of gin near the head of our bed. I would need it before daylight. My musing was interrupted by the telephone. The cheery voice of an old school friend asked if he might come over. He was sober. Notice that's in squiggly writing. He was sober. It was years since I could remember his coming to New York in that condition. I was amazed. Rumor had it that he had been committed for alcoholic insanity. Now, he's referring to this fellow named Ebby Thatcher. And Ebby and Bill were old school buddies. They had met each other over here in Vermont years ago. They had done a lot of drinking together. The last Bill heard about Ebby is Ebby was to be committed to the state insane asylum here in the state of Vermont for alcoholic insanity. That's what they used to do with people like us. Long before the treatment centers came along, they would haul us in front of the judge. The judge would commit us to the state insane asylum for alcoholic insanity for an undetermined period of time. You were to stay there until you got well. Think about that. And about anybody could do that for you. Your spouse could do it for you. Your adult children could do it for you. Members of the law enforcement agency could do that for you. Or any interested friend could do it for you, too. And the last Bill heard is Ebby was about to go to the Nut House over here in the state of Vermont, Joe.
Ebby's family was a very prominent family from Albany, New York. Most of you know that. We were at Ebby's grave here earlier this year over in Albany. Kind of an experience for us. But anyhow, Ebby's family very prominent over there, and his father was the mayor of Albany at one time, and he was running for re-election, and Ebby's drinking was embarrassing. So he told Ebby, he said, "Boy, I want you to get out of town, come over here to East Dorset, and go to the old summer place and fix it up while you're there, and sober up while you're at it. Basically, get out of town." So he came over here, and he began to fix up and paint up the old summer place. One day he stood back, and of course he was drinking, and he was admiring what he'd done, been painting the side of the house. And these pigeons were flying, roosting under there, and they began to do some things on his side of the wall that he didn't like. So he went in the house and got his shotgun out and began to shoot at those pigeons, blowing holes in the side of the house. Well, the neighbors don't like this, so they called the police. And the police come and got him and took him to jail. They took him before the judge, Judge Graves, by the way. And two fellows interceded on Ebby's behalf. One of them, his name was Roland Hazard, and the other was Seabrook Graves, which was the son of the judge. And they told the judge that they were both going to the Oxford groups, and would they release Ebby into their care, and they would take him to the Oxford group, and maybe he could find a way to stay sober. Well, the judge didn't want to put him in the insane asylum then, no more than they want to do it today. So they released Ebby to their care, and they began to take him to the Oxford groups, and sure enough, he began to stay sober. About 3 months later, he moves to New York. And he goes to the Calvary Mission, where he was the headquarters of the Oxford Group in New York at that time. And while he was there, he began to remember his friend Bill, who had a drinking problem. And he said, "I think I'll go visit Bill, and maybe I can help Bill stay sober as I'm staying sober."
Now, Bill didn't know any of that, though. No. All he knew was Ebby was to be committed to the Nut House. That's the last he had heard. Mm-hmm. He said, "I wondered how he had escaped." Mm-hmm. Of course, he would have dinner, and I could drink openly with him. Unmindful of his welfare, I thought only of recapturing the spirit of other days. There was that time we'd chartered an airplane to complete a jag. His coming was an oasis in this dreary desert of futility. The very thing an oasis drinkers are like that. The door opened and he stood there fresh-skinned and glowing. There was something about his eyes. He was inexplicably different. What had happened? I pushed a drink across the table and he refused it. Disappointed but curious, I wondered what got into the fellow. He wasn't himself. "Come, what's all this about?" I queried. He looked straight at me, simply but smilingly, he said, "I've got religion."
Mm.
Now, I'm damn glad that didn't happen in my kitchen. I have no idea what I would have done. But here's what Bill did. He said I was aghast. So that was it. Last summer, an alcoholic crackpot. Now I suspected a little cracked about religion. He had that starry-eyed look. Yeah, the old boy's on fire all right. But bless his heart, let him rant. Besides, my gin would last longer than his preaching. But he didn't know ranting. In a matter-of-fact way, he told how two men had appeared in court, persuading the judge to suspend his commitment. They had told of a simple religious idea,
which is step two,
and a practical program of action,
which is steps 3 through 12.
That was 2 months ago, and the result was self-evident. It worked. Now then, Bill knows all three things. He got the problem from Dr. Silkworth back in the summer of 1933. Now he gets the solution to it, here referred to as a simple religious idea. Remember, Ebby's coming out of the Oxford groups. They were a group of people practicing first-century Christianity to the best of their ability. And many of the terms that they used were highly religious in nature. And Bill refers to this as a simple religious idea, the need for the vital spiritual experience. Also, Ebby gives him the practical program of action necessary to have that spiritual experience. He now knows all three things. Let's see where he goes with them.
Let's go to page 10. Bill has took step 1, as we've seen. And on page 10 and 11 and part of 12, He's somewhere between step one, which he's already took, and step two. He's in between. See, he talked for hours. Childhood memories rose before me. I could almost hear the sound of the preacher's voice as I sat on those still Sundays way over there on the hillside. There was that pauper temperance pledge I never signed. My grandfather's good-natured contempt of some church folk and their doings. His insistence that the spirits really had their music. But his denial of the preacher's right to tell him how he must listen. His fearlessness that he spoke of these things just before he died. These recollections welled up from the past. They made me swallow hard. Of course, we know that Ebby's mother had gone off to be an osteopathic physician. And
Bill's mother.
Bill's mother, excuse me. And Bill's father had run off and left him and went to Canada. So that left Grandfather Griffith and to raise Bill. He's an abandoned child. And so he raised him the best he could. And I could just hear him telling Bill, those people right over here, they try to tell you what to do and how you must believe. But he said, you probably said you can have a power greater than yourself. You see, I can just see him talking to Bill that way right here today. He said, that wartime day in old Winchester Cathedral came back again. He said, I would always believe in a power greater than myself. I'd often ponder these things. I was not an atheist. Few people really are. For that means blind faith in the strange proposition that this universe originated in a cipher and aimlessly rushes nowhere. My intellectual heroes, the chemists, the astronomers, or even the evolutionists, suggested vast laws and forces at work. But despite contrary indications, I had little doubt that a mighty purpose and rhythm underlay all. How could there be so much precise and immutable law and no intelligence? I simply had to believe in the spirit of the universe who knew the time and the limitation. But that was far as I had gone.
Quite easy to see that Bill's having a little problem with this simple religious idea that Ebby's brought to him. He's having difficulty in believing what Ebby's saying to him. Let's see where he changes this belief.
He said, with ministers in the world of religion, I parted right there. When they talked of a God personal to me, who was love, superhuman strength, and direction, I became irritated and my mind snapped shut against such a theory. To Christ, I conceded the certainty of a great man, not too closely followed by those who claimed him. His moral teaching, most excellent. For myself, I had adopted those parts which seemed convenient and not too difficult. The rest I disregarded.
Does anybody in here besides me identify with Bill Wilson? Almost my same exact feelings. Let's go down to the third paragraph on page 11. But my friend sat before me, and he made the point-blank declaration that God had done for him what he could not do for himself. His human will had failed. Doctors had pronounced him incurable. Society was about to lock him up. Like myself, he had admitted complete defeat. Then he had, in effect, been raised from the dead, suddenly taken to the scrap heap, to a level of life better than the best he had ever known. Had this power originated in him? Obvious it had not. There'd been no more power in him than there was in me at that minute, and this was not at all. This is where the identification process is so important. Bill knew about Ebby, and he knew how Ebby drank. And he knew that if Ebby had been sober for a couple of months, some power greater than Ebby had to be working in Ebby's life. Bill could see that. Even though Bill didn't like it, it's absolutely beside the point. Ebby's sitting there as living proof. That's what you and I have to offer to the newcomer today when we go talk to them. We're sitting there as living proof. Some power greater than human power is working in our lives also. Whether the newcomer likes that or not, that's absolutely beside the point. We are the proof of it. Ebby was the proof of it to Bill.
Let's go to page 12 now. He said, despite the living example of my friend, there remained in me the vestiges of my old prejudice.
Even though Bill could see that in Ebby, he still, this religious idea, these things are giving him a lot of problem.
Every time you see the word old prejudice, a prejudice means old ideas. The word God still aroused a certain antipathy. When the thought was expressed that there might be a God personal to me, this feeling was intensified. I didn't like the idea. See, Ebby was coming from the Oxford group, and they were interested in the first century Christianity, which was very strict. They were interested in the letter of the law. Later on, Bill was to learn from his grandfather about the spirit of the law. Two different things. He said, I could go for such conceptions as creative intelligence, universal mind, or spirit of nature, but I resisted the thought of the desire of the heavens, however loving his way might be. I have since talked with scores of men who felt the same way. In other words, Bill's saying there's got to be a harder way to do this. What you're saying is too simple and too easy.
I wish I could have been there that day. Ebby's sitting there, and he's coming out of the Oxford groups, and he's had this great spiritual experience, and he is on fire with his stuff, and he's trying to give it to his friend Bill. Bill's sitting there about two-thirds drunk, been drunk now for about 3 weeks, and he doesn't want to talk about God, period. And Ebby's trying to talk about God, and Bill's trying to resist him. You know how we are when we get into those situations. And I guess finally Ebby got tired of it. Let's look at the next statement very, very carefully. You'll notice it's in squiggly writing, too.
That's italic.
He said, My friend suggested what then seemed a novel idea. He said, well, why don't you choose your own idea of God? The indifference how you believe. The only question is, are you willing to believe? We're no longer talking about religion. Now then, we're talking about spirituality. And it removed all argument from Bill. He had nothing left to fight about, nothing left to argue about, and here's the effect it had on him. He said, that statement hit me hard. It melted the icy intellectual mountain whose shadow I'd lived and shivered many years. I stood in the sunlight at last. It was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required of me to make my beginning. I saw that growth could start from that point. Upon a foundation of complete willingness, I might build what I saw in my friend would I have it. Of course I would. And surely this is when Bill took step two. No step two written in those days. But here's where Bill came to believe. And he came to believe on the simple idea, well, Bill, let's quit arguing about who God is. Let's quit worrying about whether he's God or Yahweh or the Great Spirit. Said, why don't you just choose your own conception of God? And I think the reason it worked so good for Bill, the reason it's worked so good for millions of we alcoholics, is we've never had any problem with our own conception of anything. Yeah, you let us believe in God the way we want to, then we're okay. I never had a problem with God in my life. I always had a problem with somebody else's conception of God. But let me have my own conception, and you betcha I'm willing to believe now. And Bill was too. This opened the door for him.
I don't believe Ebby really understood what he was doing here. But that statement and this idea of you can choose your own conception of God has opened the door for literally hundreds of thousands of us alcoholics into this way of life.
He said, upon a foundation of complete willingness, I might build what I saw in my friend. This is Bill's first reference now to a wonderfully effective spiritual structure. And he's going to paint in our mind a picture. And eventually he's going to tell us what this structure is, and we're going to pass through it to freedom. The beginning of the structure is the foundation. Willingness is the foundation. That comes from step one. When we can see that what we're doing is no longer going to work. When we absolutely, completely give up, as Bill did, and admit complete defeat, then we become willing to change. Willingness is the foundation of the structure. Later on, we're going to see that believing, step two, is the cornerstone of the structure. And later on, he'll tell us exactly what this structure is. And we'll look for it as we go through the book. A wonderful, wonderful way to teach, painting pictures in our minds using words. We've now put the foundation in. And we've also put the cornerstone in. We've become willing to believe or willing to change based on the simple idea that we can have our own conception of God. Ebby immediately started taking Bill to Oxford group meetings. But remember, the allergies got him. He can't stop drinking. Eventually, he has to be placed back in the town's hospital for the third time. And on page 13, Ebby comes to visit with Bill in the towns, and they begin to apply the Oxford group tenets in Bill's life to the best of their ability. We've seen him take step one. We've seen him take step two. Now let's see if we can't see steps 3 through 12 on page 13.
Bill was in the hospital again December 11, 1934. He said,
There I humbly at the hospital I was separated from alcohol for the last time. Treatment seemed wise, for I showed signs of delirium tremens. There I humbly offered myself to God as I then understood him to do with me as he would. I placed myself unreservedly under his care and direction. I admitted for the first time that of myself I was nothing, that without him I was lost.
The first tenet of the Oxford groups was surrender. And we see Bill making his surrender to God here. Later on, when he wrote the steps, he knew no self-respecting alcoholic would surrender. So he changed that to made a decision. We see Bill taking there what we know today as our step three, their first step or first tenet.
He said, I ruthlessly faced my sins.
Their second tenet was examine your sins. And Bill knew no self-respecting alcoholic's going to do that. So he changed that to made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. We see him there taking what we know today as step four, when he said, I ruthlessly faced my sins.
And became willing to have my newfound friend take them away root and branch. I've not had a drink since.
Became willing to have my newfound friend take them away root and branch. Later he expanded that into steps six and seven, where he became willing to have God remove these defects of character, humbly ask him to do so. And if you'll notice, the word friend in this statement is capitalized. Bill uses many, many words in the big book to identify God. He will always capitalize them. Here he's talking about God, steps six and seven.
He said, my schoolmate visited me, and I fully acquainted him with my problems and deficiencies.
And there he's taking what we know today as step five, with Abby in the town's hospital.
So we made a list of the people I'd hurt toward whom I felt resentment. I expressed my entire willingness to approach these individuals, admitting my wrong. Never was I to be critical of them. I was to right all such matters to the utmost of my ability.
And there he's dealing with what we know today, steps eight and nine.
He said, I was to test my thinking by the new God conscious within. Common sense would thus become uncommon sense.
And that step later became step 10, where we continued to take personal inventory.
He said, I would sit quietly when in doubt, asking only for direction and strength to meet my problems as he would have me. Never was I to pray for myself, except as my request bore on my usefulness to others. Then only might I expect to receive, but that would be in great measure.
And there we see all the elements of step 11, where we sought through prayer and meditation, so on, so on, so forth.
He said, my friend promised when these things were done that I would enter upon a new relationship with my Creator, that I would have the elements of a way of living which answered all my problems.
It's got to be the first part, step 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps.
He said, belief in the power of God, plus enough willingness, honesty, and humility to establish and maintain the new order of things were essential requirements. Simple, but not easy. A price had to be paid. It meant the destruction of self-centeredness, and I must turn in all things to the Father of Light who presides over us all. Poor old alcoholics got to give up the two most important things in our life, and the first thing is our alcohol, and the second thing is our self-centeredness, two things we love the most.
Very simple idea, but sometimes extremely difficult to do. Bill said these were revolutionary and drastic proposals.
Four steps.
But the moment I fully accepted them, the effect was electric. There was a sense of victory followed by such a peace and serenity as I'd never known. There was utter confidence. I felt lifted up as though the great clean wind of a mountaintop blew through and through. God comes to most men gradually, but his impact on me was sudden and profound. Bill thought he was going crazy. He said, for a moment I was alarmed and called my friend the doctor to ask if I were still sane. And he listened in wonder as I talked. Finally, he shook his head, saying, something has happened to you I don't understand, but you'd better hang on to it. Anything is better than the way you were. We don't know what happened to Bill. We were not there to see that. But we do know this was probably about December the 13th or 14th of 1934. We do know that Bill didn't die until January of 1971. We do know that he never found it necessary to take another drink of alcohol as long as he lived. He always said that he had a vital spiritual experience in the town's hospital as the result of these steps. This is why he was able later on, when he wrote How It Works, to be able to take these Oxford Group tenets, expand them into the last 10 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Most certainly, he had a spiritual experience of some kind. Remember, Dr. Silkworth said, a spiritual experience, Dr. Jung told Roland Hazard a long time ago, that a spiritual experience is old ideas cast aside. We're going to find it's a personality change sufficient to recover. Bill went in the town's hospital, a very selfish, self-centered human being. He went in the hospital with a great desire to succeed and prove to the world that he's important and just as good as anybody else. He went into the town's hospital with the idea that money, power, and prestige were the important things of life. Let's look at his new attitude now that he's had his spiritual experience.
Something profound happened to Bill. He said, while I lay in the hospital, the thought came that there were thousands of hopeless alcoholics who might be glad to have what had been so freely given me. Perhaps I could help some of them. They, in turn, might work with others. Something profound happened to Bill that morning because he begins to start thinking about how he might help other people. That wasn't his normal way of thinking. He said, my friend had emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all my affairs.
This time, friend is a little F. He's referring to Ebby again.
Particularly was it imperative to work with others as he'd work with me. Faith without works was dead, he said, and how appallingly true for the alcoholic. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. And if he did not work, he would surely drink again. And if he drank, he would surely die. Then faith would be dead indeed. And with us, it's just like that. My wife and I abandoned ourselves with enthusiasm to the idea of helping other alcoholics to a solution to their problems. It was fortunate for my old business associates remained skeptical for a year and a half, during which I found little work. I was not too well at the time and was plagued by waves of self-pity and resentment. This sometimes nearly drove me back to drink. But I soon found when all other measures failed, work with another alcoholic would save the day. Many times I've gone to my old hospital in despair. On talking to a man there, I would be amazingly lifted up and set on my feet. It's a design for living that works in rough going. You know, the work is really, really hard, but the pay is really, really good, too. Bill gets to stay sober and live a really good life.
Thank God Bill remembered this when he was in Akron, just about to get drunk, and remembered how back in New York City, even though he had never helped another alcoholic, every time he had tried, he himself had felt better. So in desperation, Bill called on Dr. Bob, not to sober up Bob, but to keep Bill from getting drunk. And thank God, Bob sobered up, and Bill didn't get drunk, and the end result is we have Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, his whole attitude and outlook upon life changed. Old ideas were cast aside, replaced with a new set of ideas. Something profound took place in Bill's life that day, in the town hospital in New York City. Now, if we're brand new in AA, we've never had any contact with the fellowship before. The only contact has been the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. We've read the doctor's opinion. We've been able to see that our problem is not willpower. It's not poor character. It's not sin. That it's an actual physical allergy, coupled with an obsession of the mind. We've been able to see how that makes us absolutely powerless over alcohol. If we've read and studied Bill's story, we've been able to identify with another alcoholic. We've been able to see the progression of his alcoholism, which was so similar to my own. We've been able to see him reach absolute, complete bottom. Then we've been able to see him affect a recovery from that. And by the time we're through with Bill's story, we should begin to have a little hope now. We should begin to have a little belief now that we're enough like this guy named Bill Wilson here in the book, that if he could recover from that condition, just maybe we could too. The beginning of belief, the beginning of hope, comes through Bill's story. And I don't think it's by accident, but by now we could hardly wait to be able to really see what took place in Bill's life and what actually happened to him. And I don't think it's by accident. The very next chapter says there is a solution. There's a solution of what's been described in the doctor's opinion. There's a solution to what we saw in Bill's story. And it starts on page 17. If we are powerless, and surely by now we know that from the doctor's opinion and Bill's story, if we are powerless, then obviously the answer is going to lie within power. And on page 17, they're going to give us two powers. They're going to talk about the power of the fellowship, which supports us. And then they're going to talk about the power of the common solution, which changes us. And those two powers added together should be enough to overcome our powerless condition over alcohol. So the prescription for the illness of alcoholism is written on page 17. Let's look at this power that they're talking about.
Abby presented Bill with his solution. Now Bill is going to present us with a solution. I have this friend who's dead now. His name was Harold, and he used to say that there's as many different solutions as there are people in AA. And I said, now Harold, if you read the chapter heading on page 17, it'll tell you how many solutions there are. There is a solution, one. Many powers, two powers specifically, but there are many, only one solution. Said, we of Alcoholics Anonymous know thousands of men and women who were once just as hopeless as Bill. Nearly all have recovered. They have solved the drink problem. Said, we're average Americans. Today we have transcended the borders of America and we're all over the world. AA has a presence. My last count was 154 countries around the world. So we're average citizens of the world today in AA. All sections of this country and men's occupations are represented, as well as many political, economic, social, and religious backgrounds. We are people who normally would not mix.
We sit here this morning, and we look at the people in this room, and we're probably the most mixed up group of people in the state of Vermont this morning.
Right.
All different backgrounds, all different religions, all different economic backgrounds, all different races, all different this. We're people who normally would not mix. That's one of the things about the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. That even though we are people who normally would not mix, there still exists among us.
See, but there exists among us a fellowship, a friendliness, and understanding which is indescribably wonderful. And you know, I got sober on the fellowship of the Alcoholics Anonymous. I got sober on the spirit of AA. And before the meeting started today, where everybody was talking, drinking coffee, telling jokes, and laughing and that, that's the spirit of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I stayed sober on that fellowship and that spirit for a long time.
Now, Bill is going to describe this fellowship by telling us a little story about something he assumes we would already know about. All good writers do this. They take something you already know about and use that to teach you something new or to make a point that they want to make. You know, we had a great writer that lived a couple thousand years ago, and he was really good at that, a great teacher. And when he wanted to teach something to the fisherman, he told him a story about fish, knowing the fisherman would understand. But if he wanted to teach the same thing to the shepherd, he would change his story and he would talk about sheep, knowing the shepherd would understand. When he went to the farmer, he talked about cattle and grains. All good teachers do that. Bill does this all the way through the book. And when you see what he's doing with it, it makes it so much easier to understand him. He said, we are like the passengers of a great liner. The moment after rescue from shipwreck, when camaraderie, joyousness, and democracy pervade the vessel from steerage to captain's table, back in the 1930s, the great ocean liners, that was the mode of transportation from one continent to another, long before air travel as we know it today became popular. And in the great ocean liners, there was a distinct class system. If you were an immigrant coming maybe from Europe to the United States, and you didn't have hardly any money, you usually traveled in what they call the steerage section of the ship, way down in the bowels of the ship. Very little fresh air, dormitory-style living. I call it the cheese sandwich section. Wasn't a very good place to travel, but it didn't cost much money to travel there either. Now, if you had some money, though, and you wanted better transportation, you could buy third class. That would bring you up a deck or two, living a little bit better, the food a little bit better, and everything else. Then you could buy second class. In second class, you're getting up into some pretty good living area, some nice staterooms, the food is much better, and hell, you can see outside the windows now and get a little fresh air. But if you got enough money, you can ride in first class. In first class, you have the best accommodations, the best staterooms. You eat in the best dining rooms, the best service, the best food, the best everything. But even then, that's still not the elite position on the ship. The real elite position on a great ocean liner was to be invited to dine at the captain's table. If you had enough money, the right kind of money.
Old money.
If you had the right ethnic background, if you had the right religion, if you had the right everything, you may be invited to dine at the captain's table, and only a few people got to dine there. Best food, best service, best everything. It's a long ways from the steerage section to the captain's table. And a journey across the ocean, these people should never have met each other. In fact, they even had separate stairwells where they couldn't accidentally run into each other. But, and I think about the Titanic, and surely it was still fresh on everybody's mind, the night it hit the iceberg, these two guys are standing at the rail. One of them is in his finery. He just came from the captain's table. Got his tuxedo on, his tie, his jewelry, his everything. Standing next to him is a guy who's made his way upstairs somehow from the steerage section. Standing there with his old work clothes on, his old Brogan type shoes. And these two guys have nothing in common with each other, period. But when they jumped overboard and their butts hit that cold ice water, for the first time they had something in common. How in the hell do we save ourselves? They grabbed onto each other, held onto each other, and I doubt very seriously if the man from the captain's table demanded an economic situation or report from the man from the steerage section. Those that were saved, when they got back on another ship or they got back on land, there was a feeling amongst them that was indescribably wonderful. One of the greatest feelings a human being can experience is to be with a group of people who have escaped from the same common peril. That's one of the greatest things in Alcoholics Anonymous, period, is this feeling we have for each other. We don't care where you came from. We don't care how much money you got. We don't care what your background is. We don't care whether you're rich, poor, whether you're Democrat, Republican, whether you're Catholic, Protestant, Jew, or whatever. The only thing we care about, are you an alcoholic? Have you escaped from the same peril we escaped from? And that gives us a tremendous amount of support for each other in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. But now he warns us. He says, unlike the feeling of the ship's passengers, however, our joy in escape from disaster does not subside as we go our individual ways. Those two guys got back on shore and they looked at each other and they said, man, we don't belong together. And they went their individual ways, probably never to meet again. But our common peril is always right outside the door, just waiting on us. And our joy and escape does not subside as we go our individual ways. We find groups of Alcoholics Anonymous all over the world. We walk in there, we feel comfortable, because we are with people who have shared and who have experienced the same things that we have. But now listen to it. The feeling of having shared in a common peril is one element in the powerful cement which binds us. But that in itself would never have held us together as we are now joined. In other words, the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is one of the great powers that hold us together. But that in itself would never have held us as we are now joined. The great fact, the tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. The great news that this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism is not the news of the fellowship. It is the news of the common solution. And a little later on, we're going to see the common solution is the vital spiritual experience brought about by the last 10 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. So he gives us two powers: the power of the fellowship that supports us, the power of the common solution which changes us. Those two powers joined together will be enough power to overcome our alcoholism, but we are warned that fellowship alone is not sufficient. I think one of the greatest tragedies I see in the world today, and I see lots of them, one of the greatest tragedies I see today is that we people who are members of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, we're spending literally hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of men and women work hours trying to attract other alcoholics to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous when we've got literally hundreds of thousands who are already members of the fellowship that are dying from untreated alcoholism. Because all they're doing is participating in the fellowship. They're doing nothing about the common solution. They're not undergoing a spiritual experience. They're not changing. And after a while, they go back to drinking again. And they say, well, AA didn't work for me. No, they didn't do the work that AA requires in order to recover from alcoholism. Now, why didn't they do that? Well, it's very simple. Nobody's telling them what they need to. Nobody's taking them here to page 17. Nobody's showing the newcomer that we got these two powers. Nobody's taking the newcomer by the hand anymore and walking with them through the steps and help them have a spiritual experience so they can recover from alcoholism. I think that's our responsibility. It's not the newcomer's fault. It's our fault. And I said there that I said the other day I wasn't going to preach anymore, but I'm really not going to preach anymore. This is all the preaching, Joe.
I hope you don't believe that. Okay. You know, the first half of this chapter tells us why the fellowship alone is insufficient. Then the last half of this chapter talks about the common solution. So let's go to page 20 now.
A good textbook never tells you something, but what it won't explain itself. So what he's just told us, he's now going to explain. He's going to show us why fellowship alone is not sufficient.
He told us on page 17 he thought we might miss it, so he's going to repeat it again over here on page 20. All right, it says, you may already have asked yourself why it is that all of us became so very ill from drinking. Doubtless you are curious to discover how and why, in face of expert opinion to the contrary, we have recovered from a hopeless condition of mind and body. Now, if you're an alcoholic who wants to get over it, you may already be asking, well, what do I have to do? Well, it's the purpose of this book to answer such questions specifically. Remember last night we talked about precise, specifically, with clear-cut direction. Well, there's one of those words, specifically. We shall tell you what we have done. Before going into detailed discussion, it may be well to summarize some points as we see them. How many times people have said to us, I can take it or leave it alone. Why can't he? Why don't you drink like a gentleman and quit? That fellow can't handle his liquor. Why don't you try and beer and wine and lay off the hard stuff? His willpower must be weak. He could stop if he wanted to. She's such a sweet girl, I should think he'd stop for her sake. The doctor told him that if he ever drank again, it would kill him. But there he is, all lit up again. Now, these are commonplace observations on drinkers which we hear all the time. But back of them is a world of ignorance and misunderstanding. We see that these expressions refer to people whose reactions are very different from ours.
And we're going to look at two kinds of drinkers that these expressions that Joe just read would refer to. First one, moderate drinkers.
Moderate drinkers have little trouble giving up liquor entirely if they had good reason for it. They can take it or leave it alone.
You know, we've already talked about them. They're the ones that have a couple of drinks. They get a slightly tipsy, out-of-control feeling. They get the beginnings of a nauseous feeling. They don't like those feelings. So one or two drinks is all they want to take. These expressions that Joe read would certainly refer to the moderate drinker.
Then we have a certain type of hard drinker. He may have the habit badly enough to gradually impair him physically and mentally. It may even cause him to die a few years before his time. Now, if a sufficiently strong reason, ill health, falling in love, change of environment, or the warnings of a doctor becomes operative, if they do, this man can stop or moderate, although he may need, find it difficult and troublesome and may even need a little medical attention.
We call this guy the heavy or the hard drinker. They drink like we alcoholics drink, but they're not alcoholic. If a good enough reason presents itself to them, they may learn to moderate their drinking. They do not have the physical allergy. Or they may quit drinking entirely. They do not have the obsession of the mind. They drink like we drink, but they're not alcoholic. And you and I see them all the time. They're the ones that said, when I was in the service, I was an alcoholic also. But when I got out of the service, I got married, went to church, quit drinking, and I don't see why in the hell you can't. You know, they drank like us, but they're not alcoholics. The expressions that Joe read here in the beginning would refer also to that heavy drinker. Now, but what about the real alcoholic? He may start off as a moderate drinker. Many of us did. He may or may not become a continuous hard drinker. Many of us stayed periodic. But at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink. Now here on page 21 and into page 22, we're going to have the description of the real alcoholic. And when you see one in here that fits you, would you please hold your hand up? We'd like to see if we're in a room full of real alcoholics.
At some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink. They talk about crossing over a line into alcoholism. Well, I don't know what line they were talking about, but I was drunk when I went over it.
Yeah. Now, here's a fellow who's been puzzling you, especially his lack of control. He does absurd, incredible, tragic things while drinking. He's a real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. He's seldom mildly intoxicated. He's always more or less insanely drunk. His disposition while drinking resembles his normal nature but little. Anybody in here like that?
When I start drinking, I get good looking and out of debt, just like that. He may be one of the finest fellows in the world, yet let him drink for a day, and he frequently becomes disgustingly and even dangerously antisocial.
Anybody in here get meaner in hell when they start drinking? You betcha. I've tried to whoop them all. I never whipped a damn one of them, but I always tried.
Couldn't lick my lips. He has a positive genius for getting tired at exactly the wrong moment, particularly when some important decision must be made or engagement kept.
Anybody in here end up getting drunk at the wrong time all the time?
Everybody kind of identifies with this, too. He is often perfectly sensible and well-balanced concerning everything except liquor, but in that respect, he is incredibly dishonest and selfish. Now, Charlie really identifies with this next one. He often possesses special abilities and skills and aptitudes and has a promising career ahead of him.
Anybody identify with that? I never heard anybody say that about us, though, except we alcoholics. I've never heard a Al-Anon say that yet.
He uses his gifts to build up a right outlook for his family and himself, and then he pulls the structure down on his head by a sensitive series of sprees. He is a fellow who goes to bed so intoxicated he ought to sleep the clock around. Yet early the next morning, he searches madly for the bottle he misplaced the night before. If he can afford it, he may have liquor concealed all over the house to be certain no one gets entire supply away from him to throw down the waste pipe. Phyllis and I used to buy a lug of whiskey, one to that's three-fifths, one to share, and one to drink, and one to hide from each other. You see, three-fifths. One to drink, one to hide from each other. As the matters go worse, he begins to use a combination of high-powered sedatives and liquor to quiet his nerves so he can go to work. Then comes a day when he simply cannot make it and he gets drunk all over again. Perhaps he goes to a doctor who gives him morphine or some sedative which to taper off. I never did taper off, I always tapered on. Then he begins to appear at hospitals and sanitariums. Now this is by no means a comprehensive picture of the true alcoholic, as our behavior patterns vary, but this description should identify him roughly.
You know, I think if our government has ever done anything right in the field of alcoholism, it may be an education of the public as to what alcoholism is and what it isn't. And because of that, a lot of the stigma has been removed from alcoholism. And many, many people are getting to us today before they have to do all these things that identify the real alcoholic. But I'll guarantee you, if you're a real alcoholic, you found yourself in there somewhere. At least one of them you're going to identify with. In my own particular case, almost every one of them applies. One especially. If he can afford it, he may have liquor concealed all over his house to be sure no one gets his entire supply away from him. When I was 7 years sober, I sold a 40-acre, 45,000 broiler chicken operation. For years after that, once in a while I would meet the guy that bought it, and sometimes he would wave and grin, and he'd say, "Hey, Charlie, we have found another one." And he's referring to partially empty vodka bottles behind corner posts, under rocks, in hollow trees, falling out of feed bins. Hell, he found them for years. Certainly, I found myself there. The book says this is by no means a comprehensive picture of the true alcoholic, because our behavior patterns vary, but this description should identify him roughly. Now, here's the question. Why does he behave like this? If hundreds of experiences have shown him that one drink means another debacle with all its attendant suffering and humiliation, why is it that he takes that one drink? Why can't he stay on the water wagon? Moderate drinker can, the heavy drinker can. Why can't the alcoholic? What has become of the common sense and willpower that he still sometimes displays with respect to other matters? Perhaps there never will be a full answer to these questions. Opinions vary considerably as to why the alcoholic reacts differently from normal people. We're not sure why, once a certain point is reached, little can be done for him. We cannot answer the riddle. We know that while the alcoholic keeps away from drink, as he may do for months or years, he reacts much like other men. We are equally positive that once he takes any alcohol, whatever, into his system, something happens, both in the bodily and mental sense, which makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. The experience of any alcoholic will abundantly confirm this. Now, these observations, the ones I just read, would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body.
Would you read that again, please?
Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body. If you ask him why he started on that last bender, the chances are he'll offer you any one of 100 alibis. Sometimes these excuses have a certain plausibility, but none of them really make sense in the light of the havoc an alcoholic's drinking bout creates. They sound like the philosophy of the man who, having a headache, beats himself on the head with a hammer so that he can't feel the ache. If you draw this fallacious reasoning to the attention of an alcoholic, he will laugh it off or become irritated and refuse to talk. Once in a while, he may tell the truth. You know, strange as it may seem, there are times we alcoholics tell the truth. Not very often, but once in a great while. You know, I had a lady who was in Al-Anon came to me one day, and her husband's still drinking. She said, "Charlie, all he does is lie, lie, lie." She said, "How can you tell when one of you guys are lying?" And I said, "Lady, watch him closely. And if you see his lips moving, he's probably lying to you, all right." And then I said, "Do you want me to tell you how to keep him from lying?" And she said, "Yeah, yeah." I said, "Don't ask him those stupid questions." I said, "Hell, he don't know the answer any more than you know the answer." Now, here's the truth. The truth, strange to say, is usually he has no more idea why he took that first drink than you have. Some drinkers have excuses which are satisfied part of the time, but in their hearts they really do not know why they do it. Once this malady has a real hold, they are a baffled lot. There is the obsession that somehow, someday, they will beat the game, but they often suspect they are down for the count. Now, there's the word obsession. Remember, an obsession in the mind is an idea that overcomes all ideas to the contrary. An obsession in the mind is an idea that is so strong that it can make you believe something that isn't true. The truth is that we cannot successfully drink alcohol, but the idea that someday, somehow, we're going to beat the game. Someday, somehow, we're going to find some kind of alcohol we can drink without getting drunk. Someday, somehow, we're going to find a group of people we can drink it with. Someday, somehow, that idea is so strong that it makes us believe that it's okay to drink. Just before we take the first drink, we are stone cold sober. No alcohol in our system, period. So our real problem centers in our mind telling us we can drink rather than in our body that ensures we can't. Let's go over to page 24. First paragraph, full squiggly writing.
That's italic.
Very, very important.
He said, "The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into conscience with sufficient force the memory and suffering and humiliation of even or a week or a month ago. We were without defense against the first drink." See, I couldn't remember what alcohol had done to me. I could only remember what alcohol did for me. And when something does what it did for me, I didn't think it was a problem. It was a solution to me. It was never a problem until it became a problem. So the almost certain consequence, in other words, I got a one from memory, it's just short. Yeah. The almost certain consequence that follow taking even a glass of beer do not crowd into the mind to deter us. If these thoughts occur, they are hazy and readily supplanted with the old threadbare idea that this time we shall handle ourselves like other people. There is complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove.
You know, if you burned your hand on a hot stove, chances are you'll always remember that. You'll remember the pain and the suffering that comes from that. Very doubtful if you'll ever go back and put your hand on a hot stove to see if it'll burn you again. Now, I remember as a kid growing up back during the Depression years, back in the 30s, and there's a few of you in here old enough to remember this too. In those days, we didn't have very much of anything. We certainly didn't have hot and cold running water like we got it today. We didn't have forced air heat like we have it today. If we had heat in the wintertime, we were lucky. We burned wood, we burned coal, we burned whatever we could get our hands on.
Other people's houses if necessary.
Joe said in their neighborhood they burned other people's houses when it was necessary to stay warm. But it didn't make any difference how poor the family is. Cleanliness was still next to godliness. In my own particular family, everybody in the family had to take a bath on Saturday night. Now, whether you need a bath or not is beside the point. Everybody takes a bath on Saturday night. One time in the middle of the winter, Mother had heated the bath water on the old heating stove in the living room, put it in a number 3 zinc wash tub sitting behind that stove, and every kid in the family takes a bath in the same water. Now, I'm the baby of the family. By the time it got to me, the crud would be about 1 inch thick on it. Mother said, "Get in there and get yourself clean." And I thought, well, how in the hell do I get clean in there? But I didn't say that to Mother. You didn't talk to Mother that way in those days. I scraped the crud to the side. I got in the water. I'm standing here next to this old red-hot heating stove. I'm washing myself, and somehow I manage to bend over and stick my rear against that hot stove. It burned a blister on my rear end about as big as my hand, hurt me worse than anything had ever hurt me up to that point. And do you know, I've never had an obsession of mine to stick my ass on a hot stove since then. I still remember today just exactly how that felt. Now, alcohol has burned me over and over and over and over and over, just as bad as that hot stove ever burned me. And for some strange reason, left on my own resources, I cannot remember what alcohol does to me. I can only remember what it does for me. And I start thinking about drinking left on my own resources. I start thinking about the great sense of ease and comfort that's going to come from a couple of drinks. The mind can only handle one thought at a time. As I think about what the first two drinks are going to do to me, that pushes out what 20 drinks did to me. And my mind forgets the hospitals, the jailhouses, the car wrecks, the divorce courts. It remembers only what, and the next thing you know, well, hell, I think it's okay to drink. That's the real problem with we alcoholics. Not the allergy of the body, but the obsession of the mind. Page 24, last paragraph.
So when this sort of thinking is fully established in an individual with alcoholic tendencies, he's probably placed himself beyond human aid, and unless locked up, may die or go permanently insane. See, the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is full of human aid, and they're just as powerless over alcohol as I am. So the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is insufficient, although it's very powerful and will help me stay sober.
Sober. Even though that's not sufficient, there is a solution to that on page 25.
And this is what it really wanted to tell us. There is a solution to the condition of the body and mind that he's been talking about. And he said, almost none of us like the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of shortcomings, which the process requires for successful consummation. But we saw that it really worked in others and had come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life that we've been living. The fellowship, I see these people in the fellowship, and I could see by them that they were staying sober and that the way I was living was not good. I could see it in the people that I knew. When, therefore, we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, there was nothing left for us but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. We have found much of heaven and have been rocketed to a fourth dimension of existence which we had not even dreamed. I like that idea of being rocketed somewhere, don't you? He said, the great fact is just this and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences.
Now, what do these experiences do for us?
Which have revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, and toward God's universe. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do by ourselves. If you notice up there, it says that we've had deep and effective spiritual experiences, and there's a little asterisk out there. And at the bottom of the page, it said fully explained on Appendix 2. Later on, referring to the asterisk on page 27, it says, for further application, see Appendix 2. And on page 47, it says, please see Appendix 2. So they want to make real sure that we understand what they mean by those terms, spiritual experience. In the first printing of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, that little asterisk was not there. And that information was not in the back of the book. And people begin to read that book and begin to read about spiritual experiences, spiritual awakenings, and they wrote into that little office and they asked Bill, what do you mean by these things? We don't understand. And certainly I didn't understand either what they meant for those terms. Because when I was about 7 years old, I told myself, if I ever get big enough they can't catch me, I'm not going anymore. Church, that is. So when I arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous, I had the spiritual knowledge of a seven-year-old boy. And that knowledge that I did have was observation from my mother and my aunt and some others. Now, one night we had a revival in Tulsa. Y'all probably don't have revivals up here in this part of the world, but we do down there. And they preach and they sing songs and they preach and they have dinner on the ground day and night for a week. And whenever they'd catch me, they'd take me. They didn't mind getting there for dinner, but I didn't want to hear the rest of it. But anyhow, one night my Aunt Mutz got into the spirit of this thing, and they were singing some songs and preaching, and my Aunt Mutz jumped up, and she started speaking in a language that I had never heard of in my life. It was awful. She started jumping up and down and dancing around. She was having a spiritual experience. And I thought that's what I was going to have when they talk about spiritual awakenings and spiritual experiences in this book. Thank God that's not true, but I didn't know it wasn't true. So for people like me, they begin to put this information in the next print about this spiritual experience and spiritual awakening. They wanted people like me to understand what they meant by those terms. So let's go back to page 569, if you will. Let's see what they meant by those terms, spiritual awakening and spiritual experiences. Because if I'm going to have one, it's probably a good idea I understood what one was, wouldn't you think?
You know, most of us get here with preconceived ideas about what a spiritual experience is, just like we had preconceived ideas of what an allergy is. Unless our thinking is the same as the author's thinking, then the information that comes through is going to be garbled information. So let's see what they really mean by spiritual experience. It amazed me when I read the appendix.
Page 569, spiritual experience. The term spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in this book, which, upon careful reading, and we know that alcoholics don't do careful reading, show that the personality change sufficient to bring out recovery from alcoholism has manifested itself among us in many different forms.
I've already learned something just from the first paragraph, that we might have two terms. We might have spiritual experience,
which is a sudden variety,
or we might have spiritual awakening,
developed slowly over a period of time.
And in either case, it's going to be a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism. Our personality is made up by the way we think, by the way we feel, by our attitudes, an outlook upon life, people, places, and things in general. So if we can change that old personality to a new personality, we will have undergone a spiritual experience or a spiritual awakening.
Okay. That spiritual experience, like I said, is a sudden variety. Spiritual awakening is developed slowly over a period of time. Dr. Silkworth referred to it as a psychic change. All three things mean the same word, a change of mind. Said, it is true that our first printing gave many readers the impression that these personality changes or religious experiences must be in the nature of sudden and spectacular evil. Happily for everyone, this conclusion is erroneous. And I was glad to hear that, because I thought I was going to have one like Aunt Mutz did. So in the first few chapters, a number of sudden revolutionary changes are described. Though it was not our intention to create such an impression, many alcoholics have nevertheless concluded that in order to recover, they must acquire an immediate and overwhelming God consciousness, followed at once by a vast change in feeling and outlook. Among our rapidly growing membership of thousands of alcoholics, such transformations, though frequent, are by no means the rule. Most of our experiences are what the psychologist William James calls the educational variety, because they develop slowly over a period of time.
You know, most of us are not going to have that sudden spiritual experience like Bill Wilson had. Most of us are going to change as we learn and as we apply. This is called the educational variety. Most of us will awaken someday to the fact that we have changed in our ideas and attitudes toward life. This is called a spiritual awakening. And the majority of us will undergo a spiritual awakening rather than the sudden spiritual experience.
See,
we change as we learn.
I do better when I know better. I didn't know any better. Quite often, friends of the newcomer are aware of the difference long before he is himself.
You know, people say to me, Charlie, you're doing okay. And I'd say, no, I'm not. Things are not a damn bit better than they were. And my sponsor would say, oh, yeah, they are. You just don't know that yet. But you'll realize that one of these days, too.
He finally realizes that he has undergone a profound alteration in his reaction to life, that such a change could hardly have been brought about by himself alone. What often takes place in a few months could seldom have been accomplished by years of self-discipline. With few exceptions, our members find that they have tapped an unsuspected inner resource, which they presently identify with their own conception of a power greater than themselves. Most of us think this awareness of a power greater than ourselves is the essence of spiritual experience. Our more religious members call it God consciousness. Most emphatically, we wish to say that any alcoholic capable of honestly facing his problems in the light of our experience can recover, provided he does not close his mind to all spiritual concepts. He can only be defeated by an attitude of intolerance or belligerent denial. We find that no one need have difficulty with the spirituality of the program. Willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery, but these are indispensable. There is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance, and that principle is contempt prior to investigation. I had the spiritual knowledge of a 7-year-old boy when I got here. I already knew all I needed to know about this, and my mind went snap shut against these theories. As a matter of fact, do y'all remember Snoopy's, Charlie Brown's teacher? When she taught, all he could hear was yah, 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 yah. Well, when they read these things and talk about these things, that's all I could hear was just yah, 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 yah. It didn't mean nothing to me at that time. My mind had snapped shut against such theories. I knew so many things that were not true, it was almost impossible for me to learn anything that was true because of my closed mind.
There seems to be one key word running all the way through this spiritual experience, and that's the word change. And Bill, like most good writers, repeated himself quite often, but when he did, he always found a different word which means the same thing. Let's look on page 569. Let's see how many times he said change and how many different ways he had of saying it. In the first paragraph, he talked about a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery. In the second paragraph, he again mentioned personality changes, but these he said in the nature of a sudden and spectacular upheaval. An upheaval is to change something entirely. In the third paragraph, first sentence, he said sudden revolutionary changes. To revolutionize something is to change it entirely. Third paragraph, last sentence, he said immediate and overwhelming God consciousness. To overwhelm something is to change it. Third paragraph, last sentence, he said a vast change in feeling and outlook. Fourth paragraph, first sentence, he said, such transformations. To transform is to change. Fourth paragraph, about the middle of it, he called it a profound alteration. To alter is to change. So the key in this whole thing is to change from what we were, restless, irritable, discontented, filled with shame, fear, guilt, and remorse. Selfish and self-centered to the extreme, to change our personality from that into something entirely different. And if we do that, then we will have undergone a spiritual experience, a spiritual awakening, a personality change, or Dr. Silkworth referred to it as a psychic change. So the real changes necessary to recover from alcoholism are brought about through the last 10 steps, which are the action steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. The fellowship will support us, but the program is what changes us, bringing about a spiritual experience.
Joe? You know, this change they talked about, I told you earlier that I had come to AA and I stood in the back of the room and I looked down at my feet and I had become everything I detested in a human being. And I did not like what I had become. So then when they talk about change in this program, at that time, I thought they meant for me to change and be something that I'm not. Because I didn't want to be me. Nobody wanted to be me. So I started looking around the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous to find me some heroes that I wanted to be like. And we need our heroes. We need the people in the Fellowship. Charlie was one of my heroes. And I did my best to become just like Charlie. Almost made it, Thank God I didn't, but I almost made it. Because I tried to emulate and be him, not being me. So today, I think, looking back at it, and I need that little exercise for a while. But looking back at it, and what I see today is I need to change from what I had become to what God intends for me to be. Just me. Because he didn't make any junk. And I'm not junk. But I need to become what God intended for me to be. And that's the type of change I think we're really talking about in AA.
Let's go back to page 25.
Bottom of the page.
Last paragraph. If you're as seriously alcoholic as we were, we believe there is no middle-of-the-road solution. We were in a position where life was becoming impossible. And if we'd passed into the region from which there is no return through human aid, we had but two alternatives.
Here they are.
One was to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could.
Which is step one.
And the other to accept spiritual help.
Step two.
And you know, that seems to be the only two choices that we alcoholics have. I hear people today say, you better not talk too much about God or you'll run the newcomer off. My sponsor always said, don't worry about talking about God. If you run the newcomer off, whiskey will put them right back in here. He said, they have no other place to go. He said, we only got one or two choices. We can stay powerless, step one, drink until we die from alcoholism, or we can accept spiritual help. And he said, apparently we have no other resources. Now, where did this idea come from? You would have thought this idea of the spiritual experience would have come surely from somebody in religion. And when I look on page 26 and 27, when I see where this really did come from, it literally blows my mind. On page 26, it said a certain American businessman had ability, good sense, and high character. We're talking about this fellow now named Roland Hazard. Roland Hazard was the one that stepped in between Ebby and the judge. Said for years he had floundered from one sanitarium to another. Same thing, we just call them treatment centers today. He had consulted the best-known American psychiatrist. Then he had gone to Europe, placing himself in the care of a celebrated physician, the psychiatrist Dr. Jung, who prescribed for him. Roland's family had plenty of money. He wore everybody out here in the States. Finally, he went to Europe, placed himself under the care of Dr. Jung, who was one of the best-known psychiatrists in the world at that time. And he didn't go there now for a 28-day treatment program. He stayed with Dr. Jung for a full year. Though experience had made him skeptical, he finished his treatment with unusual confidence. His physical and mental condition were unusually good. Above all, he believed he'd acquired such a profound knowledge of the inner workings of his mind and its hidden springs that relapse was unthinkable. Nevertheless, he was drunk in a short time. More baffling still, he could give himself no satisfactory explanation for his fall. So he returned to this doctor whom he admired and asked him point blank why he could not recover. He wished above all things to regain self-control. He seemed quite rational and well-balanced with respect to other problems, yet he had no control whatever of alcohol. Why was this? He begged the doctor to tell him the whole truth, and he got it. In the doctor's judgment, he was utterly hopeless. He could never regain his position in society and would have to place himself under lock and key or hire a bodyguard if he expected to live long. That was a great physician's opinion. But this man still lives and is a free man. He does not need a bodyguard, nor is he confined. He can go anywhere on this earth where the other free man may go without disaster, provided he remains willing to maintain a certain simple attitude. Now, some of our alcoholic readers may think they could do without spiritual help. Let us tell you the rest of the conversation our friend had with his doctor. The doctor said, you have the mind of a chronic alcoholic. I've never seen one single case recover where that state of mind existed to the extent that it does in you. Our friend felt as though the gates of hell had closed on him with a clang. He said to the doctor, "Is there no exception?" "Yes," replied the doctor, "there is. Exceptions to cases such as yours have been occurring since early times. Here and there, once in a while, alcoholics have had what are called vital spiritual experiences. To me, these occurrences are phenomena. They appear to be in the nature of huge emotional displacements and rearrangements.
Change.
Ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were once the guiding forces of the lives of these men, are suddenly cast to one side.
Change.
And a completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them.
Change.
In fact, I've been trying to produce some such emotional rearrangement within you.
Change.
With many individuals, the methods which I employed are successful, but I've never been successful with an alcoholic of your description. Asterisk, bottom of the page, for amplification, see Appendix 2. Can you just imagine the humility of this doctor? One of the world's greatest known psychiatrists. And Roland came to him and said, is there any hope for me whatsoever? The doctor could have said, "Roland, I believe you're suffering from a Valium deficiency. Let me write you a prescription, and you keep coming back, and we'll treat you for another year." But this doctor had enough humility to say, "Roland, I can't help you anymore. With all my knowledge of the mind, I've done everything I can do for you. You're probably going to die from alcoholism." And Roland said, are there no exceptions to this? And this doctor was great enough to be able to say, "Yeah, yeah. Once in a great while, I've seen people like you have a vital spiritual experience." He said, "I do not understand it. It's a phenomenon for me. But during that experience, old ideas, old emotions, old attitudes, which were once the guiding forces, are cast aside and replaced with a new set of ideas, a new set of emotions, and a new set of attitudes." Now, we don't know whether he told Roland to go to the Oxford groups or not. But we know that Roland came back to the States, got involved in the Oxford group, had a vital spiritual experience. He carried this message to Abby Thatcher. And Abby Thatcher carried this message to Bill Wilson. You know, we alcoholics who are so proud of our 12-step program, and rightfully we should be, sometimes we need to stop and think where these things actually came from. Step one came to us from a non-alcoholic doctor in New York City, Dr. Silkworth. Step two came to us from a non-alcoholic psychiatrist over in Switzerland. Steps 3-12 came to us from a group of people who were practicing first century Christianity to the best of their ability, and they were basically non-alcoholic people. Everything in our 12 steps came to us from non-alcoholics. Bill always said, he said, "I knew none of these things. And all this information gelled in my head, and from that, I was able to write the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous." Isn't that amazing, Joe?
Now, Dr. Silkworth knew what the problem was, but he didn't have a solution for it either. And Dr. Jung, he knew what the solution was, but he didn't know what the problem was. The Oxford group had a planned program of action, but they weren't interested in alcoholism at all. You see? But a great wholesale miracle has happened right there, if you will, because it said there that here and there, once in a while, alcoholics have had what are called vital spiritual experiences. Today, in AA, we could look around at each other and say to ourselves and each other that here and now, every time an alcoholic will apply these steps to their life, they too can recover. See, a wholesale miracle happened in our lifetime, and they call it Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God for that.
Let's look at another little picture, and then we're going to take a short break. We've been talking here in Chapter 2 about the solution. And we made up a little drawing to kind of represent that, show what it's talking about. And on the left-hand side of the sheet, we see the fellowship where the older members, through the sharing of their experience, strength, and hope with the newcomer, provides enough support for the newcomer to be able to stay sober for a period of time. And it's a two-way street. As the older member supports the newcomer, the older member draws strength from that too. Lots of strength, lots of power in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. It will be almost impossible to be in AA today very long and not begin to believe that there's some power greater than human power working within this fellowship. When you hear literally hundreds and hundreds of people saying it's only by the grace of God, or because of a power greater than I am, or because of God as I understand Him, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink in X number of days, weeks, months, years, or whatever. You can hardly hear that over and over and over and over and not begin to believe there must be some power greater than human power working within this fellowship. The instant the newcomer begins to believe that, then that opens the mind, and the newcomer becomes willing to investigate this thing. Upon investigation, he finds this simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. They begin to apply the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous in their lives, and lo and behold, they have a spiritual experience or a spiritual awakening. Revolutionizes their whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, and toward God's universe. A personality change sufficient to recover from alcoholism. When that happens to the newcomer, they now become an older member of Alcoholics Anonymous. They can go back to the left-hand side of the sheet. They can help support the next newcomer that comes into AA. When that next newcomer becomes willing, they can help that next newcomer apply this program in their lives so the next newcomer can have a spiritual experience and a personality change sufficient to recover from alcoholism. And if you will notice, we're basing older member not on how long we've been sober, but upon the quality of that sobriety. You know, when AA first started, way back in the 30s and 40s, there was never any doubt about this. Every newcomer was expected to work the steps. The older members helped the newcomer work the steps. Everybody was expected to have a spiritual experience or spiritual awakening. If the newcomer was not interested in that, then they were told, you might as well leave here. There's nothing we can do for you unless you're willing to make these changes. Somewhere, though, we begin to water down those changes, and we begin to concentrate on how long have you been sober, rather than upon the quality of that sobriety. And today you see all kinds of people in AA. Sometimes I see a new person in AA who's got a hold of a good sponsor. Sponsor has taken them right through the steps. They've only been sober 4, 5, or 6 months, but they're happy, they're peaceful, they're free. They're always helping AA. They're always helping other people. They're always laughing and enjoying life. They are a delight to behold. Then you see some people in AA that's been in here 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years, treated it like a cafeteria, took what they wanted and left what they wanted. They're better than they used to be, but you never know what kind of shape they're going to be in the next time you run into them. One day they're up, and the next day they're down, and the next day they're up, and they're kind of like a yo-yo going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Then once in a while you see the person that's been here 16, 17, 18, 19, 20 years. Never worked a step. Damn proud of it. And they're the ones that say, by God, if you want what we've got and you're willing to go to any damn length, you know, some of those guys you'd like to buy them a drink. Hell, you know they would feel better. So we're basing old-timer not on how long we have been sober, but upon the quality of that sobriety. And that comes about through the working of the steps and the having the spiritual experience. Let's take about a 15-minute break. We're going to come right back in. I think we lunch is 12:30 today, if I'm not mistaken. Okay, if you're ready, we'll get in about another 40 minutes here before lunch. I can almost see Bill as he's writing the book. He probably sits down and kind of reviews periodically what he's done up to this point. He's probably able to say to himself, I was able to show them the problem in the doctor's opinion and my story, Bill's story. And he says, I was able to show them the solution in chapter 2. But then he probably says to himself, they're not going to like that solution any better than I did. Remember how Bill had such a hard time with this God thing that Ebby was bringing to him from the Oxford groups. And he probably says to himself, maybe I better show them just exactly what's going to happen to them if they don't find that solution. And he sits down and he writes another chapter for us, and called chapter 3, More About Alcoholism. And in chapter 3, he talks about one thing and one thing only. Step 2 says we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Well, if we have to be restored to sanity, then it indicates we must be insane. And many alcoholics are highly offended when you bring that up. They say, oh, no, don't tell me I'm insane. Yeah, I do some pretty crazy, stupid things when drunk. But when I'm sober, I'm much like normal people. Many other alcoholics say, well, I don't have any trouble with that insanity, because I remember the crazy, stupid things I did while drunk. In either case, they are referring to the crazy, stupid things that we do while drunk as the insanity. No, that's not insanity. The crazy, stupid things we do while drunk is caused by a mind filled with alcohol. Alcohol lowers the inhibitions. And if your mind is filled with something that lowers the inhibitions, look out. You're going to do some pretty crazy, stupid things, all right. But that's not insanity. That's caused by alcohol itself. Once again, to understand this, we had to go back to the dictionary. And we looked up the word sane or sanity. And to be sane or to have sanity is defined in the dictionary as wholeness of mind or completeness of mind. If your mind is whole, if your mind is complete, then that means you can pretty well see the truth about everything around you. You make decisions based upon truth, take actions based upon truth, and life usually turns out to be pretty good. An insane mind is simply one that is less than whole. A mind that is less than whole cannot always see the truth about everything around it. It makes decisions and takes actions based upon a lie, and life usually turns out to be pretty lousy. To be insane does not mean you're crazy. You know, if you're crazy, that means you've lost more than half your marbles. And you've got to be locked up somewhere to protect you and society from you. I think one of the best ways I know of to describe it is, let's take a pie and let's cut that pie in 10 pieces and set it here in front of Joe and I. And you come along and I give you a piece of that pie. My pie is now less than whole, but I've still got 90% of it. Somebody else comes along and I give them a piece of pie. My pie is now more less than whole, but I've still got 80% of it. To be insane does not mean you're all gone. It just simply means you're not quite all here. And when it comes to alcohol, it seems as though from time to time, we're not quite all here because we can't see the truth about alcohol. And we make a decision based upon a lie, and then we run into the truth. And alcohol literally kills us. Now, what Bill is going to do through this chapter, he's going to use examples, which is a great way to teach, to let us look into the mind of we alcoholics just before we take the first drink. Can we or can we not see the truth? If we can see the truth, we're sane. If we can't see the truth, we're insane. We're going to look at the man of 30. We're going to look at a fellow named Jim. We're going to look at the jaywalker, and we're going to look at a fellow named Fred. And we're going to look in the mind to see if we can see the truth. If we can, we're saints. Bill?
Bill, in his typical manner of teaching, he's going to use various and sundry words like obsession, delusion, illusions, and insanity. And all those are the same words that means the same idea, basically. He just don't want to use the same word over and over again. So you see those words, they mean the same thing. I looked those up recently just for the heck of it. Insanity means a foolish, not mentally sound. Obsession. Disturbing preoccupation with an idea or feeling. Sounds similar, doesn't it? Illusion, a mistaken idea. Delusion, a persistent belief in something false, typical of some mental disorders. Kind of sounds like insanity to me, doesn't it? So this chapter is called More About Alcoholism. It could be called More Truth About Alcoholism, but it isn't. Bill presented us with a solution, and some of us are not going to like that solution. So he's going to tell us some more true things that's going to happen to us unless we accept that solution. He said, most of us have been unwilling to admit that we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think that he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it's not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. There's that word, obsession. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we're like other people, or presently maybe, has to be smashed.
Now you have to be careful here. He's used in these two paragraphs four different terms that basically all mean the same thing. If you see what he's doing with it, you can understand him. If you don't, he'll confuse you. He said that the great obsession of every abnormal drinker, and we know that an obsession of the mind is an idea that overcomes all ideas, all other ideas, and it's strong enough it can make you believe something that is not true. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. We all know what an illusionist is. An illusionist is a magician. They can stand in front of you and with sleight of hand and a few props make you believe something that's not true. So illusion also means to believe a lie. He said, many pursued into the gates of insanity or death. Insanity means to believe something that is not true. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost self that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people or presently maybe has to be smashed. The word delusion means the same thing. If you've deluded yourself, it simply means you've come to believe something that is not true. So you may see him using any one of four terms, all meaning the same thing. Insanity, obsession, illusion, delusion. Now let's look into the mind of we alcoholics. And let's look at the insanity, the obsession, the illusion, the delusion that we have just before we take the first drink when we're stone cold sober. Let's go over to page 32, second paragraph. A man of 30.
So the man of 30 was doing a great deal of spree drinking. He was very nervous in the morning after these bouts and quieted himself with more liquor. He was ambitious to succeed in business, but saw that he would get nowhere if he drank at all. Once he started, he had no control whatever. Now, he made up his mind that until he'd been successful in business and had retired, he would not touch another drop. An exceptional man. He remained bone dry for 25 years retired at the age of 55 after a successful and happy business career. Then he fell victim to a belief which practically every alcoholic has, that his long period of sobriety and self-discipline had qualified him to drink as other men. Out came his carpet slippers in a bottle. In 2 months, he was in the hospital, puzzled and humiliated. He tried to regulate his drinking for a while, making several trips to the hospital in the meantime. Then, gathering all his forces, he attempted to stop altogether and found he could not. Every means of solving his problem which money could buy was at his disposal. Every attempt failed. Though a robust man at retirement, he went to pieces quickly and was dead within 4 years. Now, this case contains a powerful lesson. Most of us have believed that if we remained sober for a long stretch, we could thereafter drink normally. But here is a man who at 55 years found he was just where he left off at 30. We've seen the truth demonstrated again and again. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. Commencing to drink after a period of sobriety, we are in a short time as bad as ever. If we're planning to stop drinking, there must be no reservations of any kind, nor any lurking notion that someday we'll be immune to alcohol.
We know the truth to be this. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. We've never seen one single case where one of us was able to go back and learn to drink successfully. Now that's the truth. To believe anything different than that is to believe a lie. Now is this guy's real problem the fact that he has a physical allergy to alcohol, or that he has a form of insanity that tells him it's okay to drink alcohol after X number of years of sobriety? Based upon the lie, he took a drink, triggered the allergy, end up and he couldn't stop drinking, and he's dead within 4 years. But is his real problem the fact that he has a physical allergy, or that he has a form of insanity that tells him it's okay to drink after 25 years of sobriety? The real problem centers in our mind, telling us we can drink, rather than in the body that ensures we can't drink. Let's go over to page 34, second paragraph. For those who are unable to drink moderately, the question is how to stop altogether. We are assuming, of course, that the reader desires to stop. Whether such a person can quit upon a non-spiritual basis depends upon the extent to which he's already lost the power to choose whether he will drink or not. Many of us felt we had plenty of character. There was a tremendous urge to cease forever, yet we found it impossible. This is the baffling feature of alcoholism as we know it, this utter inability to leave it alone, no matter how great the necessity or the wish. How then shall we help our readers determine to their own satisfaction whether they are one of us? The experiment of quitting for a period of time will be helpful, but we think we can render an even greater service to alcoholic sufferers and perhaps to the medical fraternity. So we shall describe some of the mental states that precede a relapse into drinking. But obviously this is the crux of the problem. Remember, just before we relapse into drinking, we're stone cold sober, no alcohol in the system at all. What sort of thinking dominates an alcoholic who repeats time after time the desperate experiment of the first drink? Friends who have reasoned with him after a spree which has brought him to the point of divorce or bankruptcy are mystified when he walks directly into a saloon. Why does he? And what is he thinking? Our first example is a friend we shall call Jim. Now, Joe just loves old Jim. He gets a little screwed up with him once in a while. Let's see what he can do with Jim today, Joe.
Yeah, I love old Jim. He's my kind of guy. This is our first example is a friend we shall call Jim. This man has a charming wife and family. He inherited a lucrative automobile agency.
He had a commendable World War record, and he's a good salesman. Everybody likes him.
Typical alcoholic, isn't he?
Yeah.
Typical alcoholic.
Just like me. He's an intelligent man and normal so far as we can see, except for a nervous disposition. Now, he did no drinking until he was 35. In a few years, he became so violent when intoxicated he had to be committed. On leaving the treatment center, he came into contact with us. On leaving the asylum, same thing. He came into contact with us. Now, we told him what we knew of alcoholism.
They told him about step one.
And the answer we had found.
They told him about step two.
Now, he made a beginning.
Then later on, we're going to see where step three is but a beginning. So apparently, Jim took steps one, two, and three, and immediately things started getting better for him.
His family was reassembled. He began to work as a salesman for a business he'd lost through drinking. All went well for a time, but he failed to enlarge his spiritual life.
We're going to find out later on the way we enlarge on step three is through 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11. Jim didn't do any of those, just steps 1, 2, and 3.
Now, to his consternation, he found himself drunk a half a dozen times in rapid succession. On each of these occasions, we worked with him, reviewing carefully what had happened.
Now, these are good AA members. Jim got drunk 6 times in a row, and every time they went over there carefully working with him to see what happened to him. You get drunk 6 times in a row today, they probably won't have anything to do with you. These were good AA members working with old Jim.
He agreed he was a real alcoholic and in serious condition. He knew he'd face another trip to the treatment center if he kept on. Moreover, he would lose his family for whom he had deep affection. Yet he got drunk again. We asked him to tell us exactly what happened, and this is his story.
They're getting a little bit tired of Jim now. And I said, "My God, Jim, this is 7 times in a row you've been drunk. Let's don't go through this anymore. Let's sit down here and you tell us just exactly how this happened." Now, we're going to look into Jim's mind, and we're going to see when he went from sane to insane thinking, from normal to abnormal thinking.
He said, "I came to work on Tuesday morning."
We read this book for years before we saw this. "I came to work on Tuesday morning." Where was he all day Monday, anyhow?
Alcoholics are bad about those Mondays.
There's a little humor in the book. It's hard to find, but here it is right here. "We bad about Mondays." He came to work on Tuesday morning.
He said, I remember I felt irritated that I had to be a salesman for a concern I once owned.
Now, I think that's normal thinking. I think any of us that had to be a salesman for a concern that we once owned, we'd probably feel a little bit irritated by that too. I think that's probably normal thinking.
See, I had a few words with the boss, but nothing serious.
Boss probably said, "Say, Jim, by the way, where were you all day yesterday anyhow?" You know, nothing serious, just enough to get us a little bit irritated.
See, Jim was a little restless and a little irritated and a little discontented about this time. He said, "Then I decided to drive into the country and see one of my prospects for a car."
What's more normal than if you want to get away from the shop for a while? You've had a few words with the boss. You're a little bit irritated about this deal. We're going to drive out in the country, and we're going to see somebody we already know, a prospect to sell a car to. Normal, sane thinking for an alcoholic car salesman.
He said, "On the way, I felt hungry, so I stopped at a roadside place where they have a bar. I had no intention of drinking. I just thought I'd get a sandwich."
What's more normal than if you're hungry to stop in a place to get a sandwich? The fact they have a bar in there is beside the point. We have no intention of drinking. We're going in here to get us a sandwich because we're hungry. Normal, sane thinking for an alcoholic car salesman.
See, I also had the notion that I might find a customer for a car at this place, which was familiar, for I've been going to it for years. I'd eaten there many times during the months I was sober.
What's more normal than to think, while I'm in there, I may find another customer? And this is not anything new. We've been going to this place for a long, long time. We've been there many times during the time we're sober. We're going in there to get a sandwich, maybe sell a car to somebody. Normal, sane thinking for an alcoholic car salesman.
He said, "I sat down at a table and ordered a sandwich and a glass of milk."
What's more normal than if you're hungry to sit down at a table, order a sandwich and a glass of milk? normal sane thinking for an alcoholic car salesman.
And still no thought of drinking. I ordered another sandwich and decided to have another glass of milk.
Now, if you're hungry enough, there's nothing wrong with two sandwiches and two glasses of milk. Unless you're a member of Overeaters Anonymous, you might need to look at it. But two sandwiches and two glasses of milk, that's normal, sane thinking for an alcoholic car salesman. Now comes the squiggly writing.
He said suddenly, and that means right now. Boom. Suddenly, the thought crossed my mind that if I were to put an ounce of whiskey in the milk, it couldn't hurt me on a full stomach.
Now, this is absolute insanity. For this guy to believe that he can take whiskey, mix it with milk, and it won't hurt him on a full stomach. Now, based on the insane idea, we make a decision and take some action.
He said, I ordered a whiskey and poured it into the milk, and I vaguely sensed I was not being any too smart, but felt reassured I was taking the whiskey on a full stomach.
Now then, we've got it inside ourselves. The physical allergy takes over now.
He said, the experiment went so well that I ordered another whiskey and poured it into more milk. That didn't seem to bother me, so I tried another. Boy, every time he did that, he was ruining two drinks, wasn't he? Putting whiskey in milk. Thus started one more journey to the treatment center for Jim. Here was the threat of commitment, the loss of family and physician, to say nothing of that intense mental and physical suffering which drinking always caused him. Now, he had much knowledge about himself as an alcoholic. Yet all reasons for not drinking were easily pushed aside in the favor of the foolish idea that he'd take whiskey if only he mixed it with milk. Whatever the precise definition of the word may be, we call this plain insanity. How can such a lack of proportion of the ability to think straight be called anything else? And if you're looking for a definition of the word insanity, there it is. A lack of proportion of the ability to think straight be called anything else.
As Jim's real problem, the fact that he has a physical allergy to alcohol, but that he has a form of insanity that tells him it's okay to drink alcohol mixed with milk on a full stomach. The real problem centers in the mind, telling us we can drink, rather than the body that ensures that we can't drink. Let's go to the bottom of page 37. Our behavior is as absurd and incomprehensible with respect to the first drink as that of an individual with a passion, say, for jaywalking. He gets a thrill out of skipping in front of fast-moving vehicles. I don't understand this guy at all. But I can see him out here on the interstate highway, waiting for a big bus or a big truck to come down through there, jumps out in front of it, spins around two or three times, sees how close it comes to hitting him without actually hitting him. For some reason, he gets a thrill out of that. I don't understand it, but I can see him doing it. He enjoys himself for a few years in spite of friendly warnings. People say, hey, John, you better quit that. You're going to get hurt. He pays no attention to them. Up to this point, you would label him as a foolish chap having queer ideas of fun. Luck then deserts him, and he's slightly injured several times in succession. He's getting a little older now. He can't move as fast. They begin to hit him once in a while. Nothing serious. He just kind of bounces off of it. Now, you would expect him, if he were normal, to cut it out. But presently he's hit again. This time has a fractured skull. He got hurt bad this time. Within a week after leaving the hospital, a fast-moving trolley car breaks his arm. He gets hurt bad again. Now, he sings their national anthem. He tells you he's decided to stop jaywalking for good. But in a few weeks, he breaks both legs. On through the years, this conduct continues, accompanied by his continual promises to be careful or to keep off the streets altogether. Finally, he can no longer work. He's beat up now. He can't hold a job. His wife gets a divorce. She started supporting him and the kids and all the hospital bills, and he's held up to ridicule. He tries every known means to get the jaywalking idea out of his head. Not his body, his head. He shuts himself up in a treatment center, hoping to mend his ways. But the day he comes out, he races in front of a fire engine, which breaks his back. Such a man would be crazy, wouldn't he? And you may think our illustration is too ridiculous, but is it? We who have been through the ringer have to admit, if we substituted alcoholism for jaywalking, the illustration would fit us exactly. However intelligent we may have been in other respects, where alcohol has been involved, we've been strangely insane. It's strong language, but isn't it true? Oh, I think that's so appropriate today. You know, once again, people are coming to us and getting into AA before they have to lose everything. Occasionally, you see somebody come in here that's still married. Once in a while, somebody will float in here and they still got a job. Believe it or not, I saw one come in not long ago and he still owned an automobile. And we start talking about insanity and they say, man, don't tell me I'm crazy. I've got my job. I've got my home. No, we're not talking about that at all. We're talking about one thing and one thing only. Can we or can we not see the truth about alcohol? If we can see the truth, we're sane. If we can't see the truth, we're insane. Now, it's probably a lot easier for the low-bottom drunk, the one who's lost everything. It's probably a little easier for the low-bottom drunk to see the truth about alcohol than it is for the high-bottom drunk. The high-bottom drunk is one who's never really lost anything from alcohol, and it's more difficult for them to see the truth about alcohol. But I'll tell you what, when the high-bottom drunk gets drunk, he gets drunk just exactly like the low-bottom drunk gets drunk. He believes a lie. He believes something that is not true. The next illustration we're going to look at is this fellow named Fred. And Fred is a perfect example of the high-bottom drunk. Fred never lost anything because of his drinking. Yet when he gets drunk just like Jim did. He believes something that is not true. And based upon the lie, he ends up drunk. Let's look at old Fred over on page 39.
Second paragraph. So Fred is a partner in a well-known accounting firm. His income is good. He has a fine home, is happily married, and father promising children college age. Now, he has so attractive a personality that he makes friends with everyone. If ever there was a successful businessman, it's Fred. To all appearance, he's a stable, well-balanced individual, yet he is alcoholic. We first saw Fred about a year ago in a hospital where he had gone to recover from a bad case of the jitters. It was his first experience of this kind, and he was much ashamed of it. Far from admitting he was an alcoholic, he had told himself he came to the hospital to rest his nerves.
We see lots of nerve resters in AA today, just like old Fred is. Yeah. Lots of them.
The doctor intimated strongly that he might be worse than he realized. For a few days, he was depressed about his condition. Now, he made up his mind to quit drinking altogether. It never occurred to him that perhaps he could not do so in spite of his character and standing. Fred would not believe himself an alcoholic. Fred wouldn't take step one, much less accept a spiritual remedy for his problem.
Can't take one, you can't take two.
Now, we told him what we knew of alcoholism.
They told him about steps one and two.
The doctor's opinion and physical allergy and the obsession of the mind. And he was interested and conceded he had some of the symptoms. But he was a long way from admitting he could do nothing about himself. He was positive that his humiliating experience, plus the knowledge he had acquired, would keep him sober the rest of his life. Self-knowledge would fix it. Now, we heard no more of Fred for a while. One day, we were told that he was back in the hospital. This time, he was quite shaky. He soon indicated he was anxious to see us. The story he told us is most instructive. Oh, here's a chap absolutely convinced he had to stop drinking, who had no excuse for drinking, who exhibited splendid judgment and determination in all his other concerns, yet was flat on his back nevertheless. Well, let him tell you about it. He said, I was much impressed with what you fellows said about alcoholism, and I frankly did not believe it would be possible for me to drink again. And I rather appreciate your ideas about the subtle insanity which precedes the first drink. But I was confident it could not happen to me after what I learned. I reasoned I was not so far advanced as most of you fellows. He's just a little bit alcoholic. That I was usually successful in licking my other personal concerns, and that I would therefore be successful where you men fail. I had felt I had every right to be self-confident. That it would only be a matter of exercising my willpower and keeping on guard. Now, in this frame of mind, I went about my business, and for time all was well. I had no trouble refusing drinks, and I began to wonder if I'd not been making too hard a term of a simple matter. We believe that Fred began to get drunk right here. His mind began to tell him, well, it's not as bad as they said it was. One day I went to Washington to present some accounting evidence to a government bureau. I'd been out of town before during this particular dry spell, so there's nothing new about that. Physically, I felt fine. Neither did I have any pressing problems or worries. My business came off well. I was pleased, and my partners would be too. It was the end of a perfect day, and not a cloud on the horizon. Old Fred was doing good, wasn't he? Making good money. Boss was happy. My home life was in good shape. He's on top of the world this time.
Never mind, it would be nice to have a couple of cocktails and go back to the hospital. Now, that's the truth, isn't it? No way he can drink on the truth. So his mind says it would be nice to have a couple of cocktails with dinner. That was all, nothing more. Now, based on the insane idea, we make a decision and take some action. I ordered a cocktail and my meal. Then I ordered another cocktail. And we've got inside ourselves now. The physical allergy takes over. After dinner, I decided to take a walk. When I returned to the hotel, it struck me a highball would be fine before going to bed, so I stepped into the bar and had one. I remember having several more that night, and plenty next morning. I have a shadowy recollection of being in an airplane bound for New York, and of finding a friendly taxicab driver at the landing field instead of my wife. The driver escorted me about for several days. I know little of where I went or what I said and did. Then came the hospital, with unbearable mental and physical suffering. As soon as I regained my ability to think, I went carefully over that evening in Washington. Not only had I been off guard, I'd made no fight whatever against the first drink. This time I'd not thought of the consequences at all. I'd commenced to drink as carelessly as though the cocktails were ginger ale. And old Jim vaguely sensed he wasn't been any too smart. Fred didn't even sense that. Fred just thought a couple of cocktails with dinner would be great. Based upon that idea, he makes a decision, takes some action, and he ends up right back in the hospital again. Now, his real problem, the fact that he has a physical allergy to alcohol, but he has a form of insanity that tells him it's okay to drink alcohol. The real problem of the alcoholic centers in the mind, telling us we can drink, rather than in the body that ensures we can't drink. Let's go to page 43, last paragraph.
You know, Bill tried to stay sober on self-knowledge, and Roland tried to stay sober on self-knowledge, and Jim tried to stay sober on self-knowledge, and Fred tried to stay sober on self-knowledge. He showed us through the illustrations of a man of 30, Jim, Jay Walker, and Fred about self-knowledge. And now, on bottom of page 43, he says once more. He's done told us a half a dozen times. Now he's going to say once more.
By the way, that's the way you have to teach alcoholics. Right. You have to tell them over and over in different ways, and eventually we get the idea after a while.
He said once more. The alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink. Except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power. So you can't heal a sick mind with a sick mind. You can't think your way out of it. You don't want to try to think your way out of it, the deeper into it you get. Because the main problem of the alcoholics is in the mind. We're trying to stay sober on self-knowledge. And this really, for me, was good information. Eventually, I finally learned that my defense must come from a higher power. I've always liked the easier, softer way, and that's it. My defense must come from a higher power.
And if you'll notice in that last paragraph, he didn't say the practicing alcoholic. He didn't say the drinking alcoholic. He just said the alcoholic. And what that means to me today is I have no effective mental defense against the first drink. It really doesn't make any difference how long I've been sober. Without the aid of a power greater than I am, eventually I revert back to the old ways of thinking, and I begin to think it's okay to drink. How many of us have seen our good friends in AA that's been sober a year, 5, 10, 15, 20, 30, 35. We've seen people over 40 years sobriety turn around and start drinking again. Get away from the fellowship. Get away from the program. Lose their contact with God. And the mind almost immediately starts reverting back to what alcohol does for us rather than what it does to us. And we become insane and we get drunk all over again. He's closed the door on me now. He's let me know just exactly what's going to happen to me if I don't find that power greater than human power. He let me know that because of the insanity, I'll revert right back to the old ideas and end up drunk all over again. And again, I think this is our responsibility to see that the newcomer understands this. It's amazing how many people in AA today still think the insanity is the crazy, stupid things we do while drunk. And I think it's our responsibility as older members to see that the newcomer understands we're not talking about what we do when we're drunk. We're talking about the state of the mind immediately preceding the first drink. Can we see the truth or can we not? If we can see the truth, we're sane. If we can't, we're insane. I think it's time for lunch. Thank you all for being here this morning. See you later.
Time we come back.
2 o'clock. Be back at 2 o'clock.